at times it's becoming farcical. You have to really feel for these players and management. This isn't normal in any shape or form. This is not a Lions tour as we know
it. For the best Lions coverage this summer, subscribe to the OTB Rugby podcast stream on the OTB Sports app.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
And you're very welcome along this Tuesday morning to OTB AM. It's Sharon Owen with you all the way through until 10 a.m. We'd love to hear from you. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. You can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. Plenty for us to get our teeth stuck into. The official, always correct power rankings are coming your way. And it's a big moment in any man's life when he's got to jump into the breach. You know that bit where you kind of hold your nose, you go under the water for the first time. You're not sure how deep it is. And you're not sure if you're going to have enough emotional heft to get back to daylight and fresh air. That's what Owen is doing today, I think. I hope. We'll see.
Yeah. That is my first experience of swimming, actually. You summed it up quite well there. As in, like, my experience of swimming last year.
First ever, yeah. Yeah. There's loads for us to talk about. We're not going to spoil that. We're going to talk about the Lions and the selection for it. And I saw somebody complaining at the weekend about the fact that the French were off busy building team spirit and patterns of play. And here we were with our best players playing in this anachronistic old thing that doesn't really matter 2 years out from World Cup. And I'm like, that's an interesting question. We might put that to Matt Williams a little bit later on. But if you've got anything you want to get off your chest, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. Owen is at his fancy new desk. It's like he's gone big time on us.
Yeah.
There was like a recent contract negotiation where he was like, no, my desk needs to be higher up than everybody else. I need to be like looking down literally and metaphorically on all of you. Otherwise, how can I deliver the power rankings?
I asked for a David Letterman desk and they gave me the desk, but not the chair. He always is looking literally down on his guests and I need to be looking down on Jer. So can we get that sorted, please? You just really cannot get the staff around here. Like, the corner had been referred to as the bold corner, so it's less of a bold corner, more of a, I guess, a teacher's desk now.
Who was referring to it as the bold corner?
Sue Murphy called it the bold corner.
Okay, fair enough. The big story overnight, and I'm not really sure if this is the big story or if this is just contract negotiations, but Henderson and contract out is how the London Times has it, and then it's the back page on several of the tabloids. Nerve Hens. Liverpool legend in contract standoff. So this is just an agent doing his job, or we've seen this before where a tiny little crack appears and light gets through the crack and all of a sudden what didn't seem like a realistic possibility is something that Liverpool decide, yeah, now's the time, let's shuffle through. We've got a bunch of players we need to get in the team. We've got a bunch of players who are not 31 and who are not going to cost the same wages as Jordan Henderson. He's unhappy with what has been offered, apparently, is the story. And so with 2 years left on his contract, he may well be on his way out of Liverpool. Give me some potential landing spots here before we talk about whether or not this might actually happen.
It's hard to know. Like, I mean, obviously the different reports kind of include different pieces of information. The Telegraph, for example, say Maurizio Pochettino, the former Tottenham manager who is now in charge of Paris Saint-Germain, is said to be an admirer of Henderson. So, I mean, could that be a potential landing spot? Is that something that is based in information that's being, I don't know, maybe being fed to the Telegraph or to other journalists around the place, that PSG, they're a rich club and they could certainly try and sign Arthur Otamendi, leader and captain?
Well, I mean, you're rebuilding the midfield that won the Champions League and the league, right?
Like the other piece of detail that seems to be included in a lot of these is that Jurgen Klopp is unhappy with losing Gini Wijnaldum, that was not something he wanted to happen. And I think we saw with his performances at the Euros that he still got a lot to offer, but there just couldn't be an agreement reached with the club, and the club weren't willing to pay his wages over the next little while and to essentially cut him loose. They were happy to lose him on a free because they weren't willing to negotiate. In a way, that puts Liverpool in a strong position because they already have shown that if you won't come down to their level of their offer, they will happily cut you loose at some point or another. Now, the thing is, Jordan Henderson is contracted at the football club until 2023, so this could be a long, drawn-out saga for the next 2 years.
Yeah, if you could just explain how they... just say that again. So that what happened was they showed how brave they are by making Gini Wijnaldum three times richer. That's how they flexed their muscles.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Gini Wijnaldum backed up the Brinks truck, the gold-plated Paris Saint-Germain made from oil Brinks truck and is now one of the richest footballers in the world.
Well, my point here
is... What a disaster for Gini Wijnaldum.
My point here is that Jordan Henderson may want to stay at Liverpool.
Maybe.
And he may be willing to take a lower, I'm not saying like the lowest possible offer, but a lower offer to stay at Liverpool and maybe move to a city like Paris, which is obviously beautiful and maybe...
Terrible, it's grim, especially in the suburbs that you'd be living in as a footballer.
I appreciate that at 7:35 this morning I've decided to clutch at straws in for no reason whatsoever, as if I've got like skin in the game here or something like that. But maybe there is a world in which Liverpool are like, we will happily cut you loose. You go and play with Kylian Mbappe and Neymar and Gini Wijnaldum and under a really good coach like Mauricio Pochettino. Because we won't pay you to actually stay here and play, or you won't be able to repay us with taking less money. So maybe my logic is a little bit flawed, but I guess in a game of chicken, which a lot of these contract negotiations tend to be, Liverpool have already proved that they will say chicken first, and they will allow you to go and talk to other people. So if Henderson is maybe using this as a bargaining chip to actually get a higher deal with Liverpool, I think Liverpool in that sort of bargaining situation are in a relatively strong position, because I mean, they're a great football club. Henderson has had some great moments with them, and I think that Liverpool know that they're in a sticky enough situation where they're not going to be investing too much in the squad until they get full stadiums back. I think that's the information that's out there as well. So it'll be next summer before a really hefty new deal will be able to be given to someone like Henderson. But you've got to remember that Henderson is older than Wijnaldum. Like, and part of the Wijnaldum idea was that,
yeah,
well, what's the long-term clawback you're going to get from investing in his talents? Like, Henderson obviously has so many different things, but like, I would have thought from Henderson's perspective, this is not quite on the level of Steven Gerrard, but would there not be like a coaching opportunity at Liverpool for him afterwards? Would there not be a chance for him to have some sort of legacy after that deal?
Well, there is. I mean, like, he's been very successful. I'm just trying to find exactly what the details on it. So Henderson is better paid than Gini Wijnaldum was. So Wijnaldum's contract, according to SpotTrack, was $4 million a year, roughly. I'm just trying to find out the exact number. I'm at 4.8, right? And Henderson's on about 7, according to 7.2 is what his current, so a weekly salary of 140 grand. And he obviously wants to renegotiate that with 2 years left. Or he wants to add on some years at the end.
I think that's a pretty strong position to be in, isn't it? Like, if you manage to extend that, that'll take you up to the age of 33. So does Henderson wants to maybe, like, he probably sees himself going till 35, maybe even beyond, but maybe 35 at Liverpool if he's allowed to be a bit part player, still keeps the captaincy. Like, I don't know. Like, I mean, Van Dijk comes back into the squad and if Henderson is not getting his starts, Van Dijk is the de facto captain, really, isn't he? Like, that's kind of the way that it would work. And if they manage to tie up all the other loose ends that are in the squad at the moment, so like if they're speaking to a number of people at the moment, a number of other people who are currently out of contract in 2023, and they're hoping to tie them up to long-term deals, Van Dijk is one of those players.
According to Fabrizio Romano, Wijnaldum's going to earn $8.6 million after tax in per annum, which is about $165 a week
after tax.
So you've got to assume essentially that's double your money,
yeah,
when it comes to what Henderson's on. So I'm not saying for a second that Jordan Henderson is motivated by money, considering the fortunes that he's made from football and also, as you've talked about, the legacy and the fact that if he were to go and play for Paris Saint-Germain, is he more or less likely to start for England in the World Cup? I don't know. Probably less likely. The evidence seems to be that you don't get picked. I mean, Kieran Trippier, I suppose, is the outlier to that. Mm. Maybe if he won the Champions League with somebody like Paris Saint-Germain. So Paris Saint-Germain won one landing spot. Are there any English teams who might be a landing spot? Like a Manchester United?
No, like, I mean, yes, he would be a brilliant signing for Manchester United if you were playing a game of FIFA. But like, in reality, I think that there's a really that there's a really nice end to Jordan Henderson's Premier League career at a mid-table club, potentially. If he wasn't playing for Liverpool, he would have thought that maybe Everton could be a nice landing spot for him. Or if Sunderland managed to get their act together and Sunderland Till I Die is a Premier League story eventually and goes back there in a couple of seasons. And I'm talking in a couple of seasons, I'm talking at the end of his contract.
Right, OK. So as a 33-year-old, you could see him going to Spurs or Arsenal or somebody.
Yeah, to Arsenal. Arsenal would take him right now, no question about that. So right now, I think that he's clearly just trying to extend his deal, and he clearly sees himself as a Liverpool player beyond 2023, if this is why we're seeing these stories. But is he going to be of use to a Premier League title challenger beyond that point? I'm not sure he is, except if that club is Liverpool. So he'd obviously have a huge material impact when it comes to maybe a younger squad and the leadership qualities that he has at the club. But he wouldn't be able to move to another Premier League challenger. And maybe even now there'd have to be a question about that. Of the other top six clubs, who would actually be interested in taking him on, given that if you're not actually Manchester City or Manchester United or Chelsea, you're probably looking to the future a little bit. You're Leicester City, basically, and you're trying to build a younger midfield, and I'm not sure if a 31-year-old Jordan Henderson actually fits in with that. And that's talking about it right now, as good as he has been and as brilliant as a player as he still is. I just don't see that happening. But I do see, in 2 years' time, a nice sunset move for him where he like battles on in mid-table Premier League. But then the easier thing to do in your career would be to go abroad and take that massive paycheck that could be on offer.
Yeah, and go and have that experience, especially for your family and your kids, and make them fluent in French or German or Spanish or Italian. Like the Italian League, he'd do pretty well in the Italian League, wouldn't he? Go and sign for one of those teams and play out a couple of seasons there. I don't know. I think that he's been very successful. I think the World Cup is probably going to factor into his plans, and so therefore you probably... My bet is that nothing happens here, right? Because he's too important to Liverpool, particularly in the absence of Wijnaldum. But I think it's interesting that these stories are popping out, and I saw Gareth Roberts suggesting on Twitter yesterday that this was just one of those off-season stories that doesn't actually end up going anywhere. But the fact that it's leaking out... Do Fenway Sports Group have enough credit in the bank to sell Jordan Henderson at the moment with their Liverpool fans after everything that's happened over the last while?
That's a good question. But also, what about the literal credit in the bank? Like, is the Wijnaldum situation going to feed into this in a way where FSG are like, probably could have got a bit more money for Gino Wijnaldum had we actually pushed him out there a little bit more after we won the Premier League title? Because that, let's face it, when we were doing the Liverpool depth chart with Gareth Roberts at the start of the season, we were talking about Wijnaldum probably not being there at the end of the season. Like Liverpool, I'm not sure, could they have done more to sell him? Like they probably saw him as a really good asset for the following season, defending your Premier League crown, not being able to bring in many new signings due to COVID. And maybe that was an exceptional situation. So maybe the reason why the story is out there now is that there is a sense that they might actually be able to cash in at some point. I know that may not exactly be music to Liverpool fans' ears, but maybe that's one of the reasons why we're seeing it. There is a reason why the story is out there. Like that, and that's the newspapers aren't just inventing the same story at the exact same time. So somebody somewhere wants this story to be published, and it's just interesting to try and pick through who's actually the one most likely to benefit from that.
So is there a possibility that Liverpool actually have decided that rather than add on another couple of years where they're not sure how much playing time they're going to get from a 33, 34, 35-year-old, if they've got to add another 3 years for him to be happy, if it's 2 years, whatever, they're still thinking, at 34, what are we going to get out of you? Then perhaps they're thinking if they can get 25, 30 million from whoever at this point, that's good business, because their track record of signing players is relatively good. And, you know, you sell him, you sell a couple of others, and suddenly you have enough money to buy one of the superstar midfielders that is out there at the moment that they've been linked with. And I'm just looking at who they've been linked with over the last week or so, and it's like a slew of midfielders.
I would say that, yeah, like that is a possibility. I would say it's more likely to come from Henderson's side just to get a new deal. It's like you could make, I don't know, you wouldn't necessarily get offered a 1 year extension at this juncture.
Nicolò Barella, Sol Niguez, Renato Sanchez, Yuri Tielemans, and Damsgaard are the ones that just on Sky today they've been linked with over the last 3 or 4 days.
Like that's a high quality of player, and Liverpool will, regardless of the Henderson situation, be looking to sign in that area, you might have thought as well, given if you're looking at some signings that maybe haven't worked in that department for them over the last little while, it is in midfield. Like the Naby Keita signing is something that hasn't worked out whatsoever for the club. It may yet do, but it's like at this point maybe not. Like they're obviously hopeful of keeping Fabinho around and in the long term, and maybe his future is more important to the club on a footballing level than Jordan Henderson's actually is. Like I obviously there is kind of like the, and I know we've said it already, there is more than just a footballing level to Jordan Henderson here. There is the importance of the man to the football club, and obviously his agent sees that as important, or somebody involved on his side of things sees it as important to actually kind of push this out. But so when it comes to the other contracts, then they're pretty confident in Alisson, it looks, at the moment, that he is going to sign a new long-term contract before the start of the coming season. Fabinho, as I mentioned, is in contract negotiations as well. That's looking positive as well. And then Virgil van Dijk, Mo Salah and Sadio Mane are going to be the other three that they're talking to. They're all up in 2023. And then their fullbacks are up the year after. And that maybe isn't a problem they're dealing with right now. But they're such important players to the club and their chances of getting back to a Premier League title challenge that you wouldn't be surprised if they're sorting that out in the near future as well.
We're all essentially writing off last season and their struggles in the league, and we're all assuming that once the centre-back partnership is established and fit and ready to go from the start of the season, that Liverpool will be full title contenders at least until March or April. That's what we're assuming?
I thought what they showed at the end of last season absolutely makes them title contenders, the way they finished the year, that we were able to write off what happened for a long time before that. Once Virgil van Dijk comes back into the squad, early season you'd imagine, then things will go back to the way they were at some point.
Okay, and the other question I'm going to ask across the show this morning, are we excited enough about the fact that the Olympics are starting on Friday? Like, does everybody realise this? That, like,
yes,
it's wall-to-wall TV coverage, that Simone Biles is going to be something that we can just turn on TV and watch. One of the greatest athletes that has ever walked the earth, and we're all going to be able to be expert in that. That the diving is going to be class. That, like, loads of things that you think that, oh, you're right, and then you're like sitting there going, "This is amazing. I need to watch more of this." Are you? Yeah. Are we? Is that why you've got the desk going?
It's why I've got the. I've got. I brought a new
so
desk.
So excited that you brought the desk to work.
I've got. There's also, like, I must say that there's like a power button here and like a couple of arrows. So I don't know what they do. But
don't press it.
They will be getting pressed at some point or another. Okay. So Simone Biles, of course, trying something that's never been seen in women's gymnastics before, she says. So no pressure, basically, on that front. And there is great detail in the Telegraph today about Team GB, which we'll get to a little bit later on in the show. You do not want to miss that.
We've got the OTB Sports Olympic show starting this evening and running for the next 3 weeks across all of our channels. It's going to be on at 5 o'clock every evening. We'll be bringing you the biggest stories of the day and also take a look ahead to what's to come. So it's the cheat sheet that you need. It's going to be brought to you in association with Indeed, who are proud to support Team Ireland at the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. Indeed believes the world works better when people are given every opportunity to unleash their true talents, and the hashtag is Talent Unleashed. Now, here's what's coming up on the show between now and 10 a.m. We're going to get some breaking news from Phil Egan in just a moment. We're going to do our power rankings. This is the GA power rankings, and I feel a change. There's a change coming. There better be. Matt Williams standing by 9:10. Sports pages at 8:30. After that, we've got Ross and Harry Byrne together. Amy Mackin, the best Gaelic footballer in the country at the moment, I think it's fair to say. And Gaelic football coming your way at 9:30. Now, a reminder, OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Phil Egan is with us with some breaking news this morning surrounding a, as yet unnamed, certainly unnamed publicly, but all over social media in the UK. Phil, good morning to you. What's going on?
Yeah, so morning, lads. A Premier League footballer has been arrested on suspicion of child sex offences. The 31-year-old man, like you said, Ger, hasn't been named, has been bailed while police continue to investigate. He's also been suspended by the club. Now, we know that it's Greater Manchester Police, and like you said, I mean, you don't have to be Poirot to work out the name being linked if you go onto social media, but we obviously urge people that are posting to post with caution, because there's a reason that the player hasn't been named yet. But it's not in that many of the papers. Obviously, it was a story that broke late enough last night. I think it's on you'll see it on the back of the Mail when you're going through the papers this morning.
Yeah, I think Everton have released a statement this morning as well, saying that one of their players has been suspended.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the statement we saw hadn't... haven't got a club affiliated to it, but certain reporters have.
But so Everton have this morning released a statement. Everton can confirm it has suspended a first-team player pending a police investigation. The club will continue to support the authorities with their inquiries and will not be making any further statement at this time. So I think everybody understands that these stories are connected at the moment, and we'll wait and see exactly what happens. But as we said, the police are not naming anybody just yet, but it's a horrific situation for the club, and also it's a very horrific story. So we will definitely keep a close eye on that as it unfolds. What else is going on, Phil?
Well, we'll find out today just how many can attend the Bohemians' second leg against Dudelange next week. This is in the Europa Conference League. Obviously, there was 6,000 at Eviva Stadium last Thursday for their win over Starnian. And it was confirmed yesterday that the second leg at the Dudelange tie will be taking place at Eviva once again. And we'll find out just how many can attend on the 29th of July. There is that hope that because last Thursday was seen as a success, that they could maybe double the attendance, but that has yet to be confirmed. But we'll find out later on today. We know that there's going to be about 9,000 supporters to see Celtic's first leg Champions League second round, second qualifying round tie against Danish side FC Midtjylland. Now, this is obviously their biggest home crowd in 18 months. It's also the first competitive game for new manager Ange Postecoglou, so a tough test to start with. That game at Celtic Park kicks off at 7:45. Limerick booked their place in the final of the Munster Under-20 Hurling Championship last night with a 127-17 point win over Clare. Limerick will play the winners of tonight's second semi-final between Tipperary and Cork at Staples Stadium. Also, both semi-finals in the Leinster Under-20 Hurling Championship this evening. You've got Dublin against Offaly at Parnell Park and Kilkenny against Galway and Tullamore. Those games all throw in at 7:30. And the number of new cases of COVID-19 among people involved in the Olympics is up 9-67. That includes the Czech volleyball player and the US gymnast who tested positive yesterday.
Okay, we know that it wasn't Simone Biles, or at least we're assuming that it wasn't, because she took a picture of herself going into the Olympic Village, which is pretty positive news from her perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that, like, I mean, it's obviously a teammate, and like a lot of the positive tests, I know, with the one of the Czech side of things, they were fully vaccinated, obviously, and are still testing positive. So it is a bit of a lottery.
Does that mean that they'll be allowed to go back in 3 or 4 days? Or is that then done for the whole thing? It's like, sorry, we're not taking any risks.
Well, there are still, this is the beach volleyball team. This is like, there is some hope that they will want to get their opening round postponed, which I think is on Sunday. So it would suggest to me that there is a week or less than a week involved in it, because, I mean, if it was like a proper 2-week quarantine or 10-day quarantine or whatever it is, then you would have thought that they'd already have forfeited that at this stage. But they're still keeping their hopes up of actually competing in that first round if they get a slight postponement, I think.
OK. Phil, the Henderson story, end of the road is the speculation on, it's a question mark really, on the back of the Star this morning, and that's in many of the tabloid papers as well. What's your read on this? It's a very important player, 2 years left on his deal. Probably looking at the massive amounts of money that Gini Wijnaldum's getting and going, come on, look what I've done for you. Come on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the owners at Liverpool have scored a few own goals in the past with ticket prices, obviously the Super League, things like that. So if they were not to tie down the captain, I don't think it would go down too well. He's just turned 31. He is the best captain the club have had in the Premier League era. I'm not saying he's a better player than Steven Gerrard, but I'm talking about the way he leads this team. And there was question marks about his future at Liverpool not that long ago when Brendan Rodgers was in charge. He was going to leave and just knuckled down, became a favourite for Jurgen Klopp, and Klopp made him captain. Surprised a few people at the time, but I think it's turned out to be an inspired choice, the way he leads on the pitch and off the pitch. And Liverpool fans absolutely adore Jordan Henderson. They don't want to see Jordan Henderson leave. We've obviously seen that the likes of Van Dijk and Salah and Alisson and Fabinho are going to sign new long-term deals. Maybe Henderson has looked and thought, you know, I should be getting a better deal than that. So this could be something that runs for a while. Now, Liverpool are actually playing tonight in Austria. They have a couple of games. The way they're doing it is they're playing two short games. They're playing two 45-minute games just as part of their pre-season. This is the first bit of action they're going to get in pre-season. So it'd be interesting to see if Jurgen Klopp is asked about it, but yeah, he doesn't want to lose somebody like Jordan Henderson. And it's something that Liverpool could do without, because we obviously know last season didn't go according to plan. The encouraging signs of the way they finished last season would give plenty of optimism for this season as well. The fact that Van Dijk is back, Gomez is back, Konate has been signed. But I still think they could do with signing a midfielder and another attacker at the very least. And you're looking for a midfielder as well that can score goals, because Liverpool, we know how good the front three have been. There were signs last season that the front three is no longer as potent as it has been. But it was quite clear that if you stop the front three at Liverpool, then you stop the scoring. So Liverpool need other options in midfield, players that can score goals.
Trent Alexander-Arnold is fit and is going to be ready to go at the start of the season. Is there a chance that Curtis Jones is the midfielder that they need?
Well, he obviously played a lot more than people would have thought last season. When Lallana left, this was a chance for Curtis Jones to step in and fill those minutes. But he really impressed. He's obviously a brilliant footballer. Sometimes there was games where you felt that he just took a bit too much out of the ball, but it's all part of the learning curve. He's an exceptional talent, and you'd imagine he's going to get more game time. Does Harvey Elliott stay at the club, or does he go out on loan? He obviously impressed with Blackburn. He's one for the future. When they signed, it was always going to be one for the future. But I just think they need somebody to replace Gini Wijnaldum. Not necessarily a like for like, but just somebody that you know you can rely on play at least 35, 36 league games throughout the season. Yeah. Is durable, and as I said, it would also help if they can contribute with goals.
Yeah, that's not Naby Keita, obviously. Feel good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers. Maybe Thiago was supposed to be that player. Maybe this year with no COVID, he'll be able to contribute a bit more as well. Paul says he must be asking for ridiculous numbers if they still haven't agreed. Liverpool are right not to cave, considering the financial climate where new deals have just been done for TV rights, which basically guarantees income for a long period of time for those super clubs, and the fact that they're going to have fans back in stadia sooner rather than later. I don't know. I think that Henderson's looking at everything going, come on, give it to me. Fergus Keogh says he's going to be 33 when his contract expires. Maybe then he'll still be a key element in the team, but it's unlikely he'll be getting a hefty deal. I don't know. I think that at 33, the way Jordan Henderson looks after himself, he could be a very important player for a team in the Premier League at the top end, or in the Champions League at that stage. So if I'm him and they're not giving me a new deal that is going to tie me down for 3 or 4 years and give me a massive pay increase, then just ride the contract out. Right, 7:57, 2 minutes late to this. Apologies for that, but we're going to get into it now. It's a big one. It's the power rankings. Owen.
Yes, indeed. So we're bringing the countdown all the way from 32 to 1, and people talk about a condensed championship being unfair on some of the counties that have got knocked out early. I think the person who is most at a loss after the condensed championship is me. These power rankings are the ones that have suffered a lack of flux. But then again, there isn't ever much flux in these because they're always 100% perfect and correct. At number 32, we have London. At number 31, we have Waterford. 30 is Leitrim. 29 is Sligo. Number 28 is Carlow. Then it's Wicklow at 27, Louth at 26, and Wexford at 25. No movement there because none of them have played a game of football since we last updated the power rankings. At number 4, we have 24, we have County Laois. At number 23, we have Longford. Number 22 is Fermanagh. 21 is Antrim. Then into the top 20. 20 is Tipperary, the first team we have called out today who've actually played a match since we last updated our power rankings. They were beaten by 11 points by Kerry. Cavan in at 19 were knocked out of the Ulster Championship after an 8-point defeat to Tyrone, and Down haven't played since either. They stay at number 18. 17 are Limerick, who got knocked out of the Championship by Cork on an 8-point win for Cork. Now, number 16 is Offaly. Number 15 is Westmeath. Number 14 is Clare. Number 13 is Derry. Cork are in at number 12. Roscommon in at number 11. Your beloved Kildare there at number 10.
No move.
No movement above County Meath.
Oh, come on. What are you doing?
What are you thinking there?
Well, I think Kildare are still in the Championship and just beat Meath the last time they played them.
Well, like, we could just put the last, what are we into now, 8 counties in as a top 8 and just settle for that. If you want to, like, we could just change the rules.
What do you mean?
And just, like, put the last counties in there as your top 8 teams.
So you're keeping Meath at 9 because against a Dublin team who had basically phoned in the second half, they did really well for a change. Is that it? It's like, happy days. You won the second half, lads. Well done. Congratulations.
That's one giant leap for Meath kind, what happened on Sunday. Really, really good compared to everything else we've seen from them in the past. I know Kildare are getting promoted to Division 1 and Meath aren't, and I would love nothing more than to drop Meath down a few pegs here, but let's see how...
Is Tommy there? Did he butt in on this? He is. Oh, Tommy, good morning to you. Hello. Jeez. Yeah.
I'm not ready there, lads. I'm not ready to go here. I'm not going to come in and make any more arguments.
Come on. You're not ready to go.
We can hear you.
You're the voice of God, essentially. So come on, tell us.
My mic isn't on. You're going to have to give me a minute.
Your mic is on. We can hear you perfectly.
I can hear everything.
Whatever
you just
excuse
said.
You have. You're live on the radio, Tommy.
Oh, he's turned off his mic.
Or we've silenced him.
I don't know what's happened there, but he couldn't hold up an argument that Meath are better than Kildare. What hope do Meath have of actually beating Dublin if they can't launch a proper argument on OTB AM that they're...
So when these are officially published today, you're going to correct that, right? That's what I'm hearing.
Not a chance. Kildare, I thought Dublin were going to beat Meath by 12 points was precisely what I predicted last week for the Dublin margin of victory over Meath. I think that Dublin could yet do that, Kildare, in the Leinster final.
And what difference does that make? We reached the Leinster final and they haven't. And also, we beat them most recently when we played. Come on, Tommy.
I'm here. I think Meath deserves to be in ninth position. They finally backed up what we've been seeing over the last couple of years with a bit of a performance against Dublin. But to be fair, it was only 15, 20 minutes. Look, Jerry, if Kildare turn around and put in a performance against Dublin, even for that amount of time, even if they show something, I'd say maybe they should be edged ahead of Meath into ninth position. But they just haven't shown anything over the last couple of years. Is this the second Leinster final Kildare in the last decade? Maybe the third? They just haven't shown enough form. I don't know. What did you make of Jack O'Connor
on
the Sunday game afterwards, saying that this has been a great year for Kildare football into Division 1, into a Leinster final? Does it feel like that?
It doesn't feel particularly great. I mean, Clare beating them in Newbridge was one of those kind of stereotypically inconsistent performances from Kildare that suggest that they're like nearly there but not quite there, nearly there but not quite there. It's like not since Geezer have they had consistency of performance and I would argue a clear identity. It's still not quite sure. Even in the Westmeath game at the weekend, absolutely devastating in patches and then completely out of the game for ages. Like if Westmeath, a bit like Meath, had taken their goal chances or had not gone for goals if they just clipped a few points when they were behind instead of going for goals, particularly that the third quarter, then it could have been a very different scenario. So
you're talking this whole thing down all of a sudden.
Well,
you just clambered off that ladder and you were like, you had a pickaxe at my power rankings and you're like, yes, I've heard the voice of God, aka Tommy Rooney from Meath Hill, and I've got off the ladder and I put the pickaxe away. That's it. That's your argument. That's, just falls like that.
That's exactly what happened to the Dubs in the third quarter last week. The Meath men stood up to them and we saw them wilt completely. That is exactly what happened.
God, you honestly, he's joking about that, but he thinks that's true. You do think that's true. You said you saw it in the Dubs' eyes. You saw it in their eyes.
Well, it was the 49th minute, Jerry, until Kieran Kilkenny scored. Look, I know the game was in GA goal, so I don't know how many people actually saw it, but...
Oh, he's going to pull the I was there card here. You have more information.
Eddie Farrell, after the match, said that Dublin were complacent at halftime. When on earth have Dublin ever been complacent over the last 10 years? And I know now, recently, they haven't been beating teams by 20 points. They've been keeping the ball. They've been holding possession. They've been killing hope. But they couldn't do it yesterday for 20 minutes.
At the start of the second half when they were 11 points up.
For 20 minutes, Jerry, but it's never happened before in Leinster. It's never happened. Like, the last time I remember that happening is maybe Mayo coming back from the dead in the 2015 All-Ireland semi-finals. They come back from 7 points down. They spooked Cluxon for a few minutes and they won a couple of kickouts and they got back into it. Like, what happened yesterday was Evan Comerford and Davy Byrne lay down as if they were shot when Meath got it back to 4 points. And they were right. That's a tactic that club teams do all around the country when you're trying to kill a bit of momentum. Meath get it back to 3 points. And to be fair to James McCarthy, I watched it back. I played the replay. I zoomed it in. I'm pretty sure Thomas O'Reilly actually caused him to fall down. But a brawl starts. Completely kills the momentum. Anyways, we've talked enough about...
No, we haven't talked enough about that. I've got two questions. First of all, would you say Dublin... we're on a level of shithousery that Italy displayed against Belgium at Euro 2020.
No, not necessarily. I don't think it was. I don't think the level of shithousery was that high. No, I don't. To be honest, I don't.
And second of all, how much are you blaming Conor Lane? I heard he had a pretty good line of vision for that penalty that they should have gotten the first half.
Yeah, I got accused of being a petty sore loser a good few times yesterday. I don't know. I just found it remarkable. I couldn't tell in real time watching it, but when I watched it back and I saw Conor Lane's position, I just couldn't believe that he didn't give a penalty.
So it looked like a rugby tackle.
Like Brian Fenton has landed on the back of Brian McMahon.
He's a big man, Brian Fenton. Now, what's he supposed to do? How can he get his own 6'12" limbs out of the way?
But like he's tripped him in the penalty box. Three points to two. And I'm not looking... Maybe that would have woken up Dublin and maybe Meade wouldn't have gotten the burst.
Was it a goal-scoring opportunity, Tommy?
I don't know if it would have been a black card, actually. I think there's two defenders in front of him. Right. But it's a penalty. It's a penalty.
Meade would have missed the penalty. We know that. That's how it works.
Well, sure, look it. We never know. We never know what would happen. It was a six-point swing very quickly. Anyways, lad. Too much talk about Meade. It's over now. Meade's year is over. But it has given us enough to cling on to. A little bit of hope. You know, it's definitely backed up what I've been saying for the last 3 years.
What? Meade, they're coming and they're good? Is that what you've been saying for the last 3 years?
It's been improvements over the last 3 years.
Okay. Good to be ambitious, Howie.
439 likes on your tweet about Conor Lane yesterday, Tommy. Congratulations.
A lot of Meade people on Twitter.
True. It's true. But they're in at ninth in the power rankings. It's a good outcome. Good outcome from the season.
The Dubs are definitely rattled. Paddy Andrews screamed in my face when Brian Fenton scored that point in the 72nd minute. Like, he screamed in my face.
what had you been doing to him
prior to that?
He had this big grin. This big grin across my face for 20 minutes. That was it, like.
I would say that was definitely not annoying whatsoever for Paddy.
No, I think he felt like the whole press box was willing me down.
Well, I'm sure they were. I think the whole country were like, oh.
That's natural. It's natural, isn't it?
Yeah. But the complacency is important. I think the complacency is important. And I'm not writing the Dubs off just yet. But I assume that our power rankings, when we reveal the next page here, is going to reveal that there's been a change at the top, Owen.
A quote from our last power rankings. If Kerry win by 15 points versus Tip and Meath get within 6 points of Dublin, I'll put Kerry top. Did either of those two things happen?
Did they not both happen?
No. They didn't get within 6 points. They got 2 6-points and Kerry only won by 11 points rather than 15.
Come on, that's exactly. They are the criteria. Well, they have reached the criteria, essentially. There was a 6-point win. They're within 6 points, 6 points.
But Kerry didn't win by 15 points.
What did they win by?
11.
Are you...
You're right.
Come on, you can't be...
I'm just looking at the numbers in front of me. Like, this is, as we all know, this is a very tight mathematical chip that I run here on the power ranking.
So you've made a change at the top, right?
There was an algorithm and computer said no when I was looking in last night to see whether or not it would allow me to put Kerry top. And all I'm looking at here is, actually, if anything, Kerry could be dropped down below Mayo, who beat Leitrim by 24 points. We'll bring up the top eight there and we can go through them.
At
number eight is Galway. They haven't played since we updated them. Their last game was against Roscommon. They stay put at number eight. Armagh are down after their defeat at the weekend because Monaghan have leapfrogged them up to sixth after winning that game. What a cracker. Donegal then down to fifth, and they've been leapfrogged by the team that they went down to as well at the weekend. I could have brought Donegal down further, maybe. Again, gone by your logic, Jerem, put Monaghan up there because they're into the Ulster final. But I think a fully fit Michael Murphy, who doesn't get sent off, maybe...
I know, but it didn't happen. So next year he'll be a year older. Next year Neil McGee might not be playing. Mm. I don't know. I can see why Monaghan coming team, the start and the end, fairly sensational. Obviously they conceded a load, but that's what happens in those games. Okay, come on. What's the story?
Tyrone at number four, Mayo at number three, Kerry at number two, Dublin at one.
Why did you not make the change? You feel it. You want it. You know it. You've been making the argument here, like, again and again and again. Come on.
Like, I mean, you've been making the argument for the last 24 hours that this was a complacent performance from Dub.
I know, but at the same time, in your power rankings, you have to be consistent. Yeah, like, essentially, everything that you asked happen happened.
No, it literally did.
A one-sided victory for Kerry, which it was. And still room
That's
for them
not
to, and still room for them to improve. It was one sided, the difference between 11 points and 15.
The literal thing that I said literally did not happen. It actually did not happen.
And the 6 points and
I said within 6 points of Dublin. Six is not within six. Six is six. And 11 is smaller than 15. A good 4 points short of 15. Like, and I'm not necessarily sure Kerry have actually been at full throttle since the league. And it's kind of hard to.
So they're periodizing nicely, rising, cresting. To hammer Cork.
Maybe, but I don't understand. Like, what was the periodisation about in the league, especially late on in the league when when they were kind of when they were safe, I guess, and that game against Tyrone. Like, I mean, they just haven't shown that form in the Munster Championship so far. Two comfortable wins, that's for sure, and you can't be overly critical of them. So you can't make the decision to actually drop Mayo or bring Mayo up ahead of them. Like, you just can't do that. But by the same token, I don't think they've done enough to say they are guaranteed to win the All-Ireland, which would be what you need to see from them to actually go to number one, I think. Because, as we've made the point yesterday, I think a team needs to be better than Dublin to actually beat them in an All-Ireland final. I think if two teams are of a similar standard, I think Dublin will beat them. So have we seen enough from Kerry so far in the Munster Championship to show that they're better than Dublin when Dublin eventually stop getting complacent? I'm not sure that that argument is actually settled yet. I think that there is every chance that Dublin get beaten, but I still think team number two, team number three, team number four there could all be the team that actually step up and take it. And it's a really exciting conclusion that we've got to the All-Ireland Championships. And maybe I'm just buying your argument from yesterday. Maybe when the Mercury did tip 30, that was it. Dublin were like, we got to conserve this energy. And and that's why we got to keep them at number one.
Give us a number. How much do Kerry have to beat Cork by to be in contention?
It's not like, well, I would say Cork are the best team they've played this year, and they will be the toughest game they've played this year. They're in at number 12 in these power rankings. Give you a number. I don't know. Like, it depends how the whole game goes. Like, I think a double digits win against Cork would be very impressive. I actually don't necessarily predict it's going
to
happen.
They'll win by 5 to 7 points, right?
I would say 4 or 5, I think, will be the margin of victory. Like, there are some people saying that Kerry are going to pulverise Cork. And I do think that if you put Dublin into Kerry's position, and I'm not talking about Dublin this year, I'm talking about Dublin over the last few years. If you put them in Kerry's position where they're in that Munster Championship, I think they actually rack up bigger wins. And I think they're even more ruthless. And I don't think they definitely would have had the issue they had against Cork last year. But even the kind of slight issues that Cork caused in 2019, I don't think Dublin would have experienced that. So the bar is extremely high here. Like,
spread is 8 points. I just checked it there. Eight points spread.
That's interesting. I think
Cork have struggled massively to get scores on the board against Kerry over the last couple of years.
And also the Killarney factor will play into it. And I know that people aren't happy with that because only 2,500 people will be in the ground. And who knows, maybe there'll be like a last minute push to a game, to a stadium with more seats than Killarney has. But then again, if they actually moved the venue and Kerry ended up getting beaten, there would be all out war. There would be panic on the streets of everywhere in Kerry if they moved the game to Cork and Cork ended up beating them, which would be kind of funny, I guess, for most people, but not for Kerry people.
Last point, I think there's a massive threat that there could be a big swing in the power rankings next week. Galway Mayo is going to go down to the wire.
You think?
Yeah, I think it is. I think.
Like, are you calling a Galway win here?
I think it's going to go down to the wire. I'm just saying that it's 8th against Mayo are in third, aren't they? 8th against third. I'm just saying that Galway team could, like, they could come alive in Croke Park the next day. And I think Mayo, without Kieran O'Connor, are just still a little suspect. They've had massive wins throughout the league, massive wins in the championship, but they just haven't had a challenge yet. And obviously, Galway have progressed a lot since they were hockeyed on day one against Kerry.
The spread is a point for that game, by the way.
Wow. So, yeah. I didn't know it was that close.
Have Mayo not come alive in Croke Park in the past?
Well, they will, and they have done. And Croke Park is definitely of benefit to Mayo. But I'd say, you know, there's a bit of a siege mentality developing in Galway over the last couple of weeks, and Pádraig Joyce might have them in the right position.
Yeah, I think that's right too. I think that I don't think Galway are ready to beat Dublin. I think Mayo might be if we get there, but I think that Mayo could be letting their mind dream a little bit about that and could get caught by Galway in that game. Oh, and I'm disappointed.
Why?
I think that you should have.
But what's in this for you, by the way? Like, I mean, this is a big
nothing,
agenda. Who's financing your
I just want you to have cojones, Co-Jones. As Marty would have said.
I've got Co-Jones for days. What's in it for you?
The power rankings are supposed to reflect the truth and accuracy, and there's like
you,
this
you
constant
think Dublin
every
are not the best
day.
Team in the country.
Every day, and like you're a one-man rumor mill when it comes to the Dubs, and yet you bring none of that information to bear when it comes to the actual power rankings. Your algorithm is flawed.
You think Dublin are not no longer the best team in the country, then?
Well, I think that if
like, I mean, it doesn't matter. Give me a definite thing here, because you seem to
I think
Kerry.
So I was about to say, I think that if Dublin win the All Ireland from this position this year, it's going to go down as good as that year that Kilkenny won the Ireland by beating Tip in the replay when it looked like they were washed up. It looked like they were absolutely finished. And they managed to wrestle it back through sheer willpower. Because if you were to say from the performances that we've seen so far, the all of the Footballer of the Year candidates over the last couple of years, maybe with the exception of Fenton, is not at the level that they have been at when they've been at their peak, despite the fact they're still in the team.
Kilkenny.
He hasn't been as good this year as he has been in previous years, has he?
He was absolutely exceptional in the first half, didn't have a great second half. I know we got to go, but I think your comparison with Kilkenny there is very, very important. I think that this might be, if Dublin win it, it'll be a huge achievement. It will not be their best All-Ireland, but it could be the last sting in the Dublin tale.
The legacy. I actually disagree with that. I actually think that the Dubs are, I don't think they're going to go through a period in the doldrums whatsoever. I think people need to strike while the iron is hot. And I'm not saying that there's no pressure on Kerry here, by the way.
Oh, sorry, Kilkenny did come back and do a two in a row and then another two in a row after that.
You better, absolutely.
They added in an extra. At the end, when they were finished, they won four more All-Irelands.
And that two in a row was almost as impressive as what they did before that. But I think there's massive pressure on the chasing pack to actually beat Dublin. I do think Dublin are in their weakest state since 2000, and let's say the most vulnerable state since 2014. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're not the best team.
I think that your mindset, unfortunately, there's no growth mindset in it. There's no opportunity for Kerry to grow in it.
I've literally got a brand new table. That is like growth mindset 101 here. I've gone out and I've asked IKEA to drop this over.
15 minutes past 8 this morning. That is this week's edition of the Power Rankings. You can give Owen hell on Twitter, or you can leave the comments in the YouTube stream, and we will, of course, bring them to you on our new patented segment, which we're still workshopping the name for, which at the moment is Feedback Corner or Feedback Loop or, you know, Constructive Criticism.
Constructive Criticism, I thought, was kind of hip and cool.
Okay, 16 minutes past 8 this morning. 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number. OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking rugby next. 17 minutes past 8 this morning, and I'm delighted to say Matt Williams is with us, and we can talk about the Lions. Matt, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Jeff. Very good, mate. Very, very good. Sun shining. Can't complain.
So there was a bit of commentary on Twitter at the weekend as the footage was emerging of the brilliant game between the Wallabies and France, and just the intensity of those three tests. Somebody was making the point after one of those 95-metre tries that only the French can score, it seems. It was like, oh, wow, look, this is what happens when you get your best players playing in the same team in a summer test series while our best players are currently either having their little hearts broken by Warren Gatland or learning new tricks from their erstwhile rivals in what seems like a very anachronistic thing that is just part of a tradition. And it's an interesting conversation to have. Do we benefit from the Lions as a rugby country, or actually is it a bit of a hindrance in the middle of a World Cup cycle? I'm not sure.
I guess you could mount arguments for both sides. I'll just give you my personal experience. The players that I was coaching who came back from the Lions tours were immeasurably better for the experience of being on those Lions tours. You know, Brian O'Driscoll was just a completely different person. In my opinion, at the end of the 2001 trip, where he'd been around all these great professionals as Ireland was still trying to learn how to be a professional organisation. Now, those days are over. The French and a Wallaby game, if we skip to that for a minute, we also have to remember that the French left a very strong, significant number of their best players out of that test side. There was no DuPonts in that side, no Aldrits. They'd left, by my estimations, 12 of their best players out. No Gael Ficou. So what Fabien Galthié did in his tremendous strategy building towards the next World Cup, he brought out, or played rather, basically one or two of his first 15 players, and the rest were his second and third 15 players, but who played exceptionally well. Now, they've just produced on their depth chart players that they did not even believe could play Test rugby. They excelled. The fullback there, who played for Perpignan, who were in the second division here in France, he selected. So it tells you how strong French rugby is. It tells you also that Australian rugby's rebuilding very much so. They were very fortunate to win the Test series. France should have won that first Test. Home, all they do is kick the ball out, and they didn't. It was just the most amazing end to a game I've seen in a long time. How France lost it was incredible. What the French did brilliantly, though, is they exploited sin bins and send-off. So Korobidi, the Australian winger, was sent off in the first minute wrongly for a high shot. He's been exonerated. It was a ridiculous decision. And the Australians, we thought, would pay a huge penalty, and they showed so much courage, which I'm delighted about, through the whole game to win it. But that try you're speaking about was how you exploit a team that is a man down. And France not only exploited it, they showed absolutely staggering individual skills and scored one of the tries of not just the season, but probably the last 10 years. It'll go down as one of the great international tries. So I guess you've got an argument on both sides for it. I think as far as Ireland go, we just look at it through an Ireland perspective. Does it give Ireland the chance to build their depth in a depth chart? Possibly. The quality of the opposition, probably not. You know, there's those guys got starts. Joey got a start. Joey Carvery got a start. We saw some really good young players get their opportunity. The quality of the opposition was obviously highly questionable in comparison to where Ireland have to go. So Ireland have to beat one of the top four to make a semi-final. They've always beaten the others, but they haven't been able to make a semi-final in the World Cup. So that means you've got to beat France, New Zealand, South Africa or England. That's the ones you've got to beat. Now, we beat England in the last Six Nations, so that's a plus. But will you beat them at a World Cup? Now, I think we needed that summer. But look, it's a mute argument, because the Lions is a cash cow and the European nations need the cash cow. It's always going to stay because it makes more money than anything they have. So I guess whether we think it's a good thing or a bad thing doesn't matter. It's staying.
I think as well, in non-COVID times, we would be in Fiji with three tests and we would be seeing the depth chart emerge, you know, a new back row, new partnerships at 9 and 10, and we'd be able to lean into the whole notion that actually having our best players away, hothouse and learning and stealing the ideas from Gregor Townsend and whoever else is on that coaching ticket. In the past, it would have been Edwards and all the other people that they would have learned from that perspective makes lots of sense, while we're also cultivating the new group of players. So I definitely see both sides as well. But the point you make
Could I make a point there? I think the last World Cup, and I'm not a critic of Joe Schmidt, because I know I've said things about the team's Joe Cash. I'm a super admirer of Joe. I think he's the best coach Ireland and Leinster ever had. So hands up, that is not it. But when Ireland went to Australia a year before the last World Cup, I was arguing to leave the good boys at home, like Sexton and Conor Murray, and bring the other guys through. They're the ones that we're missing. We've got to, and this is where we have to look what Galtier has done well. He's gone to one of the big countries in the south. Now, Australia's the bottom of the three. There's no doubt about that. But he did do exactly that. He left out his big names and put the younger guys on. That's where I think we're missing out. When we get the opportunity to go to a top-tier southern country, we're not using that opportunity, because that's where you learn. You learn a bit playing against Japan and the States and so on. It's really when you come against a really high-quality outfit. As a player, you learn, and that experience is just vital. That's where I think we're missing out.
So this November, then, much better opposition for Ireland. Would you suggest to leave Sexton out, to leave Murray out for those big tests?
I think you have the opportunity to, Owen. I'm not saying we leave Johnny or Connor out specifically, but yes, you know, would Casey and the other young players coming through benefit from starting, which is very different to coming off the bench, starting against one of these big sides? Without doubt. Without doubt. And yes, I've got to say, if I know the coaches' contracts, are signed financially that the more you win, the more you get paid. So if I'm one of those coaches, I pick that. There has to be a way to empower our coaches, like Galtier's been empowered, to not select your best players all the time without being hindered financially. Because that's certainly a reason why a lot of the coaches don't select the younger players in some matches, not all matches, but November is a great opportunity to say, okay, look, we're coming up against one of the big three from the south. We're going to sprinkle the team, not put 10 of them in, but we're going to put two or three starters in there. You know, Coombs needs to start one of these bigs. He's a huge talent coming through. That's where we're missing the opportunity. That Australian series, that Ireland won. And everyone was crying, we won the series, we won the series. And yeah, it's great. They hadn't done it since 79 when Kieran Fitzgerald led the side down to Australia. I get it. But did it do us any good at the World Cup? Answer's no. It was just a little, it's a line on history. If the goal, and that's what I mean about it, frustrates me about Ireland. If the goal is truly to win a World Cup, if you believe deeply in your soul that we can, and I've seen a number of generations of Irish players come and go that have underachieved at a World Cup because I don't believe the organisation takes that emotion into their heart. We can win a World Cup. And that's where it starts, with someone saying it and driving it. And until we get to that point, and that might mean sacrificing some other games on the way through in the cycle, until we get to that point, we're always going to struggle at a World Cup because it's a different beast. And we've got to look at the teams that are successful at World Cups. They do these things. New Zealand do it, Australia do it, France are doing it. Galtier is a smart guy. He's learned. He speaks to people. He rings them up. He talks to them. I met him a number of years ago. I was so impressed with Fabien Galtier. I knew he was going to be a great international coach after I'd spoken to him for a couple of hours. The guy is a sponge. He wants to learn and will sacrifice, as he did. He sacrificed that tour. They could have won with his best team. So what? He now has a depth chart, like almost better than everyone except New Zealand. And that's what the benefit is of sacrificing some of these tours in between World Cups.
I think it makes a lot of sense. It'll be interesting to see what happens now. We have a fairly hectic November series and then obviously the summer next year, but there's not a whole heap of time for any of these coaches to build that depth chart. So very interesting to see who can make it in the meantime. Let's move on to the Lions. And obviously we've talked about the fact that the money for the Southern Hemisphere is one of the main reasons why this will continue to be what it is, which is a bolted-in fixture in the calendar every 4 years, notwithstanding the tragedies that are unfolding in South Africa with regards to COVID and the civil unrest at the moment. These matches are going ahead, and whatever about the rights and wrongs of this, I mean, I don't know, maybe we should talk about that, because it's hard to ignore the fact that there's every reason in the world for these matches not to go ahead, and yet from South African rugby's perspective, they can't afford for them not to happen. It's a horrific situation for the people in South Africa. It's also a pretty grim financial situation for South African rugby.
Like everything, when you're dealing with South Africa, it's complicated. You know, I've written a bit about it in the Irish Times. It's not straightforward. We just have to assume, when you're dealing with South African rugby, during apartheid and post-apartheid, the politics of the national government are involved. That's, you just have to take that as a given. Be it selection of the team, pre and post apartheid, the national government is involved. For the tour to be called off would be for the national government of South Africa, which is since Nelson Mandela won the elections almost 30 years ago, has been the African National Congress. They've been the party in power. For them to allow the tour to be called off would be to saying to the world, we've lost control of our country. They're not going to do that. The deaths won't matter. Civil unrest is a different story. That's where you've got the current president trying to reclaim some of the party, the African National Congress Party, that Zuma, the previous president, had basically corrupted in what was, in the words of the South African, current South African president, state capture. And they're trying to wind that back and get control of it again. And this is, the agitation is set up by Zuma's supporters, some of them within the ANC, trying to overturn what is obviously an attempt to regain control of the government and an administration that has spiraled out of control, where we see the COVID deaths. You know, I just don't believe the numbers they're saying. The deaths in the townships and the deaths out in the black communities are much greater than the numbers we're seeing. The poverty and so on that is still existing in the townships, which is beyond imagination. I've visited them. I've visited a number of them, and I try and explain to my family what I've seen, and they can't understand it. I've been there, and I can't understand the poverty that these people have continued to live in for 30 years. So all this is all intertwined, as it has done for hundreds of years in South Africa. The mixture of the politics, the people, the parties, the beliefs, and sport has tended to be a way they express it, their beliefs, and so it's a huge mix match. These games are going ahead. Doesn't matter where. Is it moral? Well, look, I don't know. I it's not for me. I can't make a judgment on that because it is a democracy. People do vote. But is there incredible corruption? Is there illness and death because of that corruption? Are we supporting that corruption? Well, I've got to leave that up for someone else. It's certainly not what the apartheid days were. But it's a terrible, terrible place for the African people of all colours to be at the moment.
Yeah, and it's hard to know how that feeds into the emotion of the South Africans in particular who are taking the field at the weekend. And maybe Razi Rasmus is the perfect person to deal with that. I mean, Razi is somebody who, obviously in Ireland, left with a brilliant reputation as a very charismatic man who led Munster through a very difficult period and then left him in the lurch a little bit at the end. But I think everybody understands when you see the videos of him talking to the South African team that was the job that he was born to do and always wanted to do. So maybe in retrospect, Munster are happy that they had him for the short period that they did. What did you make of Razi versus Gatland on Twitter, and what's your instinct about whether or not it's a good thing to be doing to stir the pot against Gatland, and if actually that might be what Gatland wants, or is that meeting fire with fire and somebody finally standing up to Gatland? What did you take? What was your take?
Oh, there's a bit of a storm in a teacup. I think they're both laughing about it. Let's go both sides. Razi shouldn't have done that. That's not what you're supposed to do. There is agreement. Coaching staff aren't technically allowed on the field. Now, if you watch the Wallabies on Saturday, their attack coach, Scotty Wisemantle, one of my former players from Eastwood Rugby Club, a great guy, lovely man. Scotty's running water for the Wallabies. So, you know, look, every team has some sort of way of communicating. Does Gatty need to be on the field to communicate with his team? No, they've got radios. You can say it and it gets to the players immediately. So I don't believe that Razi being on the field was the difference between the sides. Should Razi have done it? Technically not. But in Razi's defence, they were smashed by COVID. They had staff that weren't allowed at the games. They couldn't bring anyone in. So they had all of those staff and non-rugby staff, they were doing jobs they weren't supposed to be doing. Everyone was all hands to the pump. We're in a bit of a crisis. We just got to get through this. So I think a little bit of understanding of Razi and his predicament is should be given. Was there a difference between the teams? Absolutely not. Does it mean anything? Absolutely not. On Saturday, when they go out and the Lions are there, are they going to get in a circle and go, and remember, Razi was running water? Come on. Like, let's be big boys here and get on with it. I mean, I just think it was Gatty being Gatty. He found something to pick at. They got beaten well and truly by a better side. That's might be why he's trying to hide it. They've had five facile games that haven't meant much. The one game that was a big game, they got beaten and they didn't manage it well. As I've said before, mate, what they did in that sin bin period when South Africa were down to 13, that was appalling. That's close to the worst 10 minutes of sin bin management by the team that had superior numbers I've ever seen. They lost the game there. And I think, you know, Gatty's good at deflecting. I think that was a deflection away from why didn't they call a scrum? Why did they, when they had a superior, a numerical superiority, did they tap the ball and go? They then had a line out and they called a five-man line out instead of calling a full line out to suck the Africans in. You've got 13, they're one forward, one back down. If you have a set play, the Africans have to make a choice where they're going to put players. And you obviously attack where they don't have them. If they had a scrum just before halftime, the Africans have got to pick a place, either a seven-man scrum and six in the back line, or do they put them in? You've got five in the back line.
So if a school team and a school captain made those decisions, you would be critical of them in the aftermath of that thing.
Like, absolutely.
What were you thinking? So there must have been some sense, we're not going to reveal, we're not going to do, like, this is the most vanilla. We're going to go out and we're going to fight the South African A team because they're physically, I want you all to feel that. But unless it's just a complete shambles, surely there's just everything is vanilla today. Don't show anything. Don't show your hand. Don't reveal your hand. If you get the chance to just tap and go, I want you to feel in your muscles what it's going to be like in the test series, lads. That's it. Surely. No? Am I wrong?
Look, you know, you don't say to your players, don't win the game. You know, like if you ever said that to any player, they never, you know, they lose all respect for you. So the primary, and you couldn't say it to the players, you've got to win. So the decision there is not coming down from on top. Okay, they were down to 13 men. We've got a penalty, there's 20 seconds to go before halftime. We've already tapped and gone seven or eight times. Like they couldn't get any more physicality in that game, surely.
Fair enough.
And they tapped and went. They picked and went. Like it seemed an eternity. I walked out to the kitchen and came back in and they were still tapping and going and running into each other. I mean, it was boring. They should have taken the scrum. And they can, and you get what a psychological advantage
yeah.
to get over the Africans where you have a scrum and you might get a penalty try. You might get a pushover try. All those things came into play. So I just thought it was really, really poor on-field management.
Does Conor Murray take the blame for some of that period?
He's captain. He has to, but surely the English captain was on the field as well. So, you know, there's a lot of leaders out there that could have said, come, let's take the scrum. So, you know, I just think it was really, I think it was a bit of arrogance, to be honest with you, that they dominated everyone else so much they were going to get over. And it was just personified. Mario Toje, you know, like a giant of a human being, one of the most powerful men I've ever seen play the game, picks and goes. He gets under Estevez, so he's physically under Estevez. Estevez is out of weakness. Estevez bear hugs him, but he's over the top. He hasn't got any leverage. He twists at Toje, picks him up and drives him back 2 metres. If ever you needed a little lesson in that, trying to out-headbutt South Africans is a lesson in futility. You are never going to do it. They are the world champions at headbutting. You've got to think about some other strategy. You had a numerical advantage, you didn't take it. That's just dumb footy, and there's no other way to put it. Now, will they learn from that, the Lions? Absolutely. Have they learned from that game? Absolutely. Has Gaddy learned from the quarterfinal at the last World Cup where they kicked the ball 40 times in South Africa, kicked it 41, and they headbutted South Africa and lost? I hope so, because if you go out in the first test and you get back to that headbutting competition, you're going to lose again. They'll win it every time. You've got to do something different to beat the Africans.
Have you seen enough to suggest that the Lions are going to win the first test? Or because, look, I don't understand it, but the bookmakers make the Lions slight favourites for the first test, and everything I've seen suggests that South Africa, A, is like 50% of what the full team is going to be this weekend. The whole, they haven't played any rugby. Well, they haven't played any rugby together, but they've all been playing world-class rugby for the best teams in the world for the last 18 months, and they are the world champions.
I'm with you, Gerald. I think I think it's a very even contest. It's not going to be, you know, I think the Lions could have won that A game, as I just said. They got a bad decision at the end of the game. I thought they definitely resented, absolutely scored a try at the end of the game, but the ball was clearly on the line. So they could have won that game. So there's not much in it. But the Africans are going to be a lot better for what they were, and they're going to have new players coming in. The Lions have got everyone but one player, but Finn Russell, available to them. Like, they are going to be a powerful outfit as well. But they've got to play something besides kick and chase and headbutt. They've got to get the ball wide. South Africa will give them opportunities, but there's going to be very few of those opportunities. There's going to be like two or three in the game. They've got to take them. If they don't, they'll lose. So I certainly wouldn't be betting on either side. I don't like losing my money because I just think it's a toss of the coin. The first test, I actually think the Lions should have an advantage, but I don't believe they do. I think the lead-up games have been so poor for them that they haven't got a massive amount out of it. You heard Tandy saying they had a 90-minute selection, being the hardest meeting they ever had. I've tried to pick a side here and I'm going, wow, I don't know. There's about seven positions could go either way. And if there's arguments for both sides, whoever you leave out, you know, how do you justify it? Whoever you put in, how do you justify it? So it's going to be a really tight, it's going to be a fascinating game. Don't get me wrong, I think it's going to be a brilliant game. It's going to be fascinating who the Lions pick in almost every position going through, including people that we thought were fastened on, like Conor Murray. Like, Conor's position's under real threat now. And a week ago, I didn't believe that. So I don't think it's going to be advantage anyone. I think it's a really even contest. I will say this. I can tell you exactly how South Africa will play. I know exactly how they play. And so does a whole lot of other rugby people in the world. They're not going to play any different. It's what the Lions do that will determine the outcome of that test. If the Lions can find a different way, and they've been trying it in their attack, hasn't been perfect, but they've been trying it. They've been trying it with their kicking game, hasn't been perfect.
Yeah.
But if they can get it right, get what they've been trying right, they've got a really good shot at it. But the Africans, they're coming route one. They're going to bash it up. They're going to give you the front of the line out. They're going to scrummage. They're going to physical. They're going to kick. They're going to chase. They're going to frustrate you. And any penalty you give within 60 metres, they're going to kick. Pretty, and that's one of three World Cups. They've been doing the same thing since 95. It hasn't changed, and it's effective.
Matt, great stuff. The appetite is suitably wet. Thanks a million.
See you guys. Great to talk to you.
Always really thoughtful stuff there from Matt Williams giving us his thoughts. If you've views, we'd love to hear them. 0879 180 180. And of course, I should remind you that the games are all live here on Off the Ball on News Talk. You can hear it at the 5 o'clock kickoff. Brian O'Driscoll and Neil Tracy on commentary duty for the first test. We're going to bring you live commentary of the three tests, obviously. The first one is the Springboks against the Lions. 5 o'clock kickoff, pre-match, post-match analysis as well from our star-studded array of analysts. And a reminder that all our Lions coverage is brought to you in association with Vodafone, lead partner of the British and Irish Lions. Really looking forward to that. We've got an interview with Ross and Harry Byrne a little bit later on this morning as well. Our mass star Amy Mackin joins us after nine. Right now, I want to play you this. It is a little bit of Eddie Brennan talking about Kyle Hayes last night. Have a listen.
I won't take away the compliments. I'll hold the compliments for a minute. But I suppose we talked a few weeks ago about the art of defending. And I think if you were to look back on it and say that a guy was going to come from his own 45 or 65-yard line and nobody was going to lay a glove on him, you'd be kind of pulling your defensive unit aside in your review and saying, guys, how did this happen? But I just know it as well, watching the match from the high behind, how Gillan again makes those runs. And he just literally ran straight at Kyle Hayes, and in doing so he brought Porrigmar with him, and Porrigmar, you know, bought it really. I suppose his brief was to stick with Gillan and mark him, and as in doing that, I suppose he just for that split second probably then realised, my priority is to protect the goal. And it's something the Tipperary were very good at, you know. I've seen in the past where they would flood that area, but you know, we have to give Kyle Hayes some credit. And What an amazing finish, even, because he had the hurdle turned the other way down with the heel of the hurdle up to the sky, which is normally you have your toe up when you're striking a ball like that. And again, he got ferocious power in it. But I mean, he was coming at such pace. All he was doing really was going to pass that ball into the net. And I think, in fairness, Barry Hogan had no hope with it. But I wouldn't like to have been chasing him. I think if as a forward, you go, oh God, you can't believe that a back scorched you from well outside midfield and went all the way and stuck it to net. It was just really was, he's a powerhouse.
Yeah, brilliant analysis there from Eddie Brennan. You can listen back to the full thing if you subscribe to the OTB GAA feed in your podcast app, so whatever app you're using. And obviously the best place these days to get that is actually on the OTB Sports app, where you can subscribe to it. And anytime we update it, if you turn your notifications on, we'll send you a little notification to go, oh, there is some fresh free content available. Will O'Callaghan is with us. Will, good morning to you.
Morning, lads. How are you getting on?
I can't remember a better score in any sport. Like, it's right up there with anything you've ever seen, isn't it?
Yeah, it's remarkable, particularly given the context of the game too. Like, this wasn't just a goal scored in some, you know, not important match. It's the middle of a Munster final when Limerick are on the crest of a wave coming back in a comeback victory against Tipperary. And I would kind of echo what Eddie said. I'm surprised that Tipperary half-back line didn't find a way to cynically pull down Kyle Hayes as it became clear that he was on a beeline toward goal. But as a neutral, I'm delighted he wasn't pulled down. And also, I actually thought that he was going to scuff the finish because his hurl was turned into a pretty unnatural angle and he had to use the boss at an unusual angle to actually try and generate any kind of power. And it's really good placement. Like, he's not taking leather off the slitter. This was a shortened grip because he could well have been hooked. The hurl's not in a good position when he throws the ball up, and yet he was able to, you know, use his technique in order to finish it off, which is not an easy thing to do after a 70-yard sprint in the blistering sun in Cork on Sunday. So a remarkable comeback and a remarkable goal which capped it too. Like, I can't think of too many other dominant performances, Gerard, that we've seen from a team, maybe with the exception of a side that Eddie Brennan was on, the first half of the All-Ireland final against Waterford, when Kilkenny, I think, scored all but one chance in that opening half at Croke Park and had the game dead by half time. That was a different type of performance, though, where they started quick and just kind of didn't let up. Yeah. While Limerick had to come back from real adversity to actually win.
Well, that was their signature performance in terms of it being the absolute best. I think their first wide is 67 minutes into the game, and TJ Reid can't make that team. That's how good that Kilkenny team was. He comes off the bench and scores 4 or 5 points and is brilliant. But that was a Waterford team who was at the end of their cycle. This is a Tip team who have 3 All-Ireland medals stitched in. Now, many of them might also be at the end of their cycle, but they are winners, and they know they had given themselves a winning position. They have a backroom team which is as smart as any backroom team that has ever been assembled, and they couldn't do anything in the face of what Limerick were doing. It's like, that's why I think when we come to write about the great performances and you try and whatever matrix you use to power rank them, it's like, I mean, it's right there with anything we've ever seen.
Yeah, look, if you're going to call it a signature performance, that is it. Like, Limerick have been remarkably good over the last 3 seasons. They have failed one meaningful test, which was when a physical battle was put up to them by Kilkenny in an All-Ireland semi-final. They've learned from that mistake and probably become a better team since. But we've seen so much dominance from Limerick. Like, Limerick won the All-Ireland last year without any real massive test outside of, say, Galway before the injuries happened. They dominated so many fixtures and they won so many games by just popping points over from distance. And there was even the accusation earlier this year that maybe Limerick were getting a little bit boring to watch because Limerick weren't going for goals and Limerick weren't putting in, you know, bombastic style performances. They were just happy to control possession and win the game because generally they had better shooters and better athletes than the teams that they were playing against. While at the weekend, we saw very little go right for them, particularly in the second quarter of that game. They find themselves down by double digits and you really have to dig in. Like, you've got to give credit to their team psychologist and backroom team too when it comes to Limerick. Like, they did not seem to panic at any stage, even when they were well down in that game. And you saw Aaron Gillan, where it was clearly a mistake by Kiley not to start him. He should have started with his best 15 and started with the player who's been so central to the way that they attack at the outset of the game. And then when he comes in, you know, as Eddie mentioned, like, it's not just the scores that Gillan picks up. It's the fact that he's able to occupy defenders and make really good runs in the final third, which makes space for the Limerick players who are coming forward. And again, like, Keane Lynch puts in like a massive performance in the middle of the field. Will O'Donoghue, I thought, had a really, really good game for them around the centre too. They shared around the scoring burden fantastically across their team when they got rolling. And I really can't think of too many better performances in the second quarter, the third quarter after halftime that Limerick put in. They blew Tipperary away. If you're Tipperary, the concern would be, Ger, exactly what you said about the end of a cycle. So many of their players are now into their early 30s at this stage. They've not been recycled despite the conveyor belt of good underage players who've been coming through in Tipperary, particularly their really good under 21 team of a few years ago. Liam Sheedy has stuck with the tried and tested, started players who have brought him to the apex of hurling in 2019, like the Mahers, like Seamus Callanan, who've become guaranteed starters and his generals on the pitch. And there are plenty of people in Tipperary who feel that younger blood should have been mixed in, particularly during the league this year. And a lot of question marks now about Tipperary, especially the way they hurled in the semi-final and drifted out of parts of that game too, ahead of this quarter-final in 2 weeks' time. I mean, I wouldn't rule Tipperary out as contenders to win the All-Ireland Championship this year, but it looks a big ask at this stage.
Will O'Donoghue, of course, called Will O'Callaghan by Michael Deignan in the middle of commentary on Sunday. This is, like, I mean, congratulations on your spot in this midfield, Will. Like, I mean,
I'm sure Casey was delighted with my assist on flicking it over the top.
So, like, what I'm interested to hear is that, like, what we've got in Kyle Hayes at the moment is a guy who is travelling from A to B. Like, he's literally about to get the tux on and pick up his All-Star for Hurler of the Year right now, and it's a sure thing. It's that path is clear. So who is going to be the cynical man who is going to stop that from happening between here and point B? Who is going to be the Lara Corbett to his Tommy Walsh between here and the All-Ireland final?
Look, I think after what happened last weekend, if he gets the motor running again in a big game and starts running from his half-back line and makes a run towards goal, I think somebody has to take him down. I mean, I know the new rule at this stage is...
Can I hang on a second?
Go on, Ger.
The next time Kyle Hayes picks the ball up inside his own half, it's a clear goal-scoring opportunity. And if you take him down, you're going to the bin and it's a penalty. Come on. The rules are rules.
Well, that's the trick. If you're going to rugby tackle him maybe in midfield where you can make an argument that there's eight players behind you.
Not enough. We've seen it now.
But yeah, once he hits the 45, like we saw last weekend, I think you'd have to consider that a clear goal-scoring opportunity, and far more so maybe than the controversial black card that we saw with Clare and Tip a few weeks back.
But like, in retrospect, now, did James Owens not make the right decision? Because we see where the goals are coming from. Like, the other goal that that Limerick scored earlier, where it's a shot from, like, it seems like the depths of hell, and it's a tap-in, obviously, because there's a save made. Like, do you know, goal-scoring opportunities in hurling, if you decide that you're going to shoot, there's a reasonable chance that the goalkeeper is going to be forced into making a save. It's an opportunity.
It's a different game to the one that I grew up watching. Like, it was a little bit more old school with Dublin and Kilkenny at the weekend, where Dublin, particularly from Nolan's puckouts, were able to go quite direct, and it felt a bit more like let the ball in long and let it in fast. But generally, with teams who now carry the ball through possession, like Limerick, like Waterford, a lot of the top teams in the country over the last 2 or 3 years, it's not unreasonable to think that if somebody picks up the ball in midfield, that with the skill levels right now and with the strength and conditioning we see with the players, that somebody who goes on a solo run, unless they are cynically taken down, have got the skill and the stamina combined to actually make a run in and create a goal-scoring chance. Still, I think the James Owen decision, I think that's actually probably a good thing to have happened early in the championship, because the referees will go off now, and when they're having their feedback from the GAA and from the assessors, the point will be made that, look, this is not the spirit of the rule that was brought in. It has to be considered an actual goal-scoring chance before you dish out a black card. And these things will balance themselves out. And we probably needed one high-profile one for it to happen. And I would hope that there's not a reaction, because there was a lot of hurling commentary afterwards, lads, that was like, oh, that's the moment. We have to ditch it now at this point. Even going back to Congress, there was plenty of us. I remember chatting to Michael Verney about it, that at some point, a corner forward would be taken down out on the wing, and a referee was going to make a decision that it was a black card offence. I would hope that what happened at the Gaelic grounds that day will now mean that referees will have a little bit more consideration about what's an actual goal scoring chance.
Well, I think we can all agree that the leniency, we're in the leniency period of the refereeing at the moment, where, yeah, not ruining the game by keeping Aaron Glan on the field was the right call at the time. Unless you're a Tip supporter, in which case you're like, that cost us that match.
Yeah, so I think that was a terrible. I think there's a difference between the two of them as well. One is not a very new rule, and another one is a brand new rule. I just want to know if the former Clare TD who suggested that there should have been a protest organised at the decision of the Gaelic Grounds still wants said protest to happen, because I mean, he's absolutely kick-started the summer, James Owens.
That's one out of the Offaly playbook from 1998. Maybe that Clare Observer was watching on what happened at Croke Park when it comes to having protests. You got to have a laugh about it. I mean, one of the things that I really liked was somebody on Twitter, and it's a pity I can't remember who it was, or I give them credit for this right now, is they actually marked out the lines between the 45-metre line where that foul had taken place and the car park at the Gaelic grounds, and they were pointing out that it was actually closer to the Ennis Road than it was to the goal at the time. So hurling people are quirky at the best of times, lads.
What else is going on, Will?
Well, boxers Kelly Harrington and Brendan Irvine will carry the Irish flag at Friday's opening ceremony at the Olympics. 2018 world lightweight champion Harrington is among Ireland's best medal prospects in Tokyo in what will be her maiden game. She says it's an incredible honour to carry the flag alongside Irvine, who is going to his second Olympics, having boxed in Rio in 2016. The number of new cases of COVID-19 among people involved in the Olympics is up 9 today to 67. It includes the Czech volleyball player and the US gymnast who tested positive yesterday. The media in the UK are saying two more positive tests in Team GB, although the six who had to self-isolate on arriving into Tokyo are now allowed to return to training today. New Celtic boss Ange Postecoglou says tonight's Champions League game is important for the club and their year ahead. They're at home to Danish side Midtjylland in the first leg of their second qualifying round tie. Celtic haven't played in the Champions League since 2018, and there will be 9,000 in attendance at Parkhead, their biggest attendance in some 18 months. A Premier League footballer has been arrested on suspicion of child sex offences. The 31-year-old man has been bailed while police continue to investigate, and he's also been suspended by his club. In transfer news, Bayer Leverkusen's Damari Gray is on the verge of a move back to the Premier League with Everton. It'll cost them around €3 million, while Atalanta goalkeeper Pierluigi Collini, who previously played for Aston Villa, is close to joining Tottenham on loan. The deal will contain an option to buy for around €15 million this summer. Limerick, as I mentioned, on a crest of a wave across all of their teams currently. They await the winners of tonight's second Munster under 20 hurling semi-final between Tip and Cork. That one starts at 7:30 at Semple Stadium. Cork were recently crowned the 2020 All-Ireland Under-20 Hurling Champions. Colm O'Neill and Adam English scored 117 between them as Limerick beat Clare by 13 points last night. And it's semi-final night in the Leinster Under-20 Hurling Championship as well. Dublin will welcome Offaly to Parnell Park, while Galway and Kilkenny clash in Tullamore. Both those games in Leinster start tonight at 7:30.
Well, good stuff. Thanks a million for that. You can read more from Will across the day on otbsports.com. It's 8:55 if you want to get in touch with us. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. And of course, you can always leave a comment on the YouTube stream as well. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're going to take you very quickly through the sports pages. We'll start with otbsports.com. And on the otbsports.com homepage,
there is some really good sports content.
And unfortunately, my internet connection is so slow.
It is. Have Kerry finally passed out Dublin? The power rankings leads the way on otbsports.com. You'll have to click into that article to find out.
Saved you a click, no. Saved you a click. No, no Co Jones this week.
The Co Jones. No Eddie Co Jones on my side of things this week, but next week, potentially.
That could be the title of the morning, dear, if you... just want to stick it up there. Irish Independent, back page headline there. Doubts hang over Henderson's Liverpool future as talks stall. Croke Park to host Ulster football final on Saturday week. Everybody's having their provincial final in Croke Park. Everybody, Owen. Everybody. All of the good provinces. Apart from, which one's not
here,
having it?
Here we go again. Here we go. Man from Kildare. Man from Kildare / Dublin thinks Kerry is as close to Dublin as Tyrone is.
What are you scared of?
Shock horror. That he thinks that would also be as logistically sensible.
But she all live up here anyway.
The most important ones do, I guess.
What are you scared of?
I would love nothing more than a day out of court. I won't be able to get to go to the game on Sunday.
Best backs nailed on starter Murray for Lions spot. The back page of The Guardian this morning. Athletes' isolation spreads panic through Team GB. Olympic fear. Health issues may force Brailsford to step down. David Brailsford's going to be leaving cycling. Apparently the stress of being the team Sky boss caused him heart issues. GB athletes fear Tokyo COVID threat at the London Times. Jones set to start first test. Alan Wynne-Jones appears set to be named in the Lions test scene. This is the team is slowly being leaked, all right. Owen Slot has details on it. Henderson in contract out. Picture Simone Biles, who was in the athletes' village yesterday. The Daily Mirror back page. Nerve Hens. Liverpool legend in contract standoff. Tokyo Olympics gets ready for a liftoff. GAA needs dubs to be reeled in. Paddy Christie believes Dublin's decline would be good for Gaelic football. There were signs over the weekend, probably for the GAA, not from a Dublin point of view. That needs to happen because the Leinster Championship has become a complete joke. It's 100% correct, Paddy, and he is probably very, very right about that. The Irish Sun, Olympic pings. Good? No good?
It's fine.
Not good enough to get the sting. Athletes also unhappy about games nightmare.
Okay, sub-headline, I think it's Tab of the Morning to you.
Well, how do you do?
Tab of the Morning.
Mainly because we're also running out of other options. I just had a quick perusal of the other options. I think it's probably the best of the bad ones.
No. The best one is actually page 3 of The Sun, which is Flap and Tickle.
What is that even to do with?
What do you mean? Flap and Tickle?
I don't know. Give us the story here. What is... I haven't checked page 3 of The Sun this morning.
So Flap and Tickle is the headline. It's a pun on Slap and Tickle.
Yeah.
You know what that is?
Yeah.
Okay. Cardboard beds to stop Olympic stars bonking.
Oh, this... Yeah. This was debunked by... Well, pardon the pun, by an Irishman, wasn't it?
What?
Rhys McLennigan went viral the other day by debunking the myth that the beds wouldn't be able to support the body weight of two athletes in one of those single cardboard beds. Because that was the theory out there, that the reason why they made them cardboard was to stop people getting into bed together and to stop the spread of COVID. Whereas Rhys McLennigan released a video on social media, jumped on the bed, and it went uber viral over the last couple of days.
Olympic athletes have been given cardboard beds apparently to prevent romps, says... The Sun story written by Ryan Parry. Organisers in Tokyo claim they are better for the environment, but some say they are to discourage competitors from sex. US runner Paul Kilimo, 30, said the beds can only support a single person to avoid situations beyond sports. Team Ireland gymnast Rhys McLennan filmed himself vigorously bouncing up and down on his mattress. In today's episode of Fake News at the Olympic Games, the beds that are meant to be anti-sex, he said. the official Olympics Twitter said of his video, which went viral. You heard it first from Team Ireland. The sustainable cardboard beds are sturdy.
I stole your thunder there. Sorry for giving the story away.
Rhys McClanahan, he is, I mean, I really hope he delivers because he's primed for world superstardom. Back page of the Herald, Henderson deal hits snag at Poole. Best backing for Murray start lines. The Daily Mail, Premier League star in child sex arrest. Club act with a suspension. Everton have released a statement saying that they have banned a first team player, or they've suspended a first team player. And the Irish Daily Star, end of the road. Croker gets Ulster final. Ange's Griffiths demand. That's a Celtic story. And Greg's pillow fight. This is the other, the Sevens team is going to be tabloid fodder because of Greg O'Shea's being part of it. Irish team wins pillow fight. Betting guru King Coyle has donated pillows to Irish Olympians in Tokyo as former Love Ireland winner Greg O'Shea showed off his cardboard bed. Mm. So
we should get Mattress Mick on the show to give him give us his expert view on cardboard beds.
Is it impossible to bonk on cardboard is the question that we would need to ask Mattress Mick.
Yeah, exactly. We'll get in touch with him. I've got a couple of other papers here this morning. The Irish Examiner goes with launch sequence, Kieran Shannon's column on the hurling over the course of the weekend, leading the way there, and Kevin McStay's column leading the way in the Irish Times. He's writing about the future of Donegal and that it looks bleak. Without Murphy and McGee. I do want to just touch on the Daily Telegraph this morning. The lead there, by the way, is Lewis Hamilton and the fallout from Silverstone at the weekend. But inside, revealed secrets of Team GB training camp and vital role played by Porridge. So, I mean, sometimes we don't want to see how the sausage is made. Do we want to see how the medal is made? Of course, this is the same construct that allowed the mind of Dave Brailsford to take over and create the medal factory before London 2012 and create Super Saturday for all the great British people everywhere and to ensure such a great sporting event. So what they're talking about here with regards to Tokyo is the lengths that they've gone to ensure that the medal factory can keep on churning them out. 8,000 pre-made porridge pots have safely arrived before anyone even set foot in Britain's preparation camp in Yokohama. They had to teach a Japanese kitchen crew how to cook one of Britain's best-loved breakfasts and something that is totally unfamiliar to them. So, Ben Bloom has spoken to Wendy Martinson, who is the Team GB lead nutritionist. And Wendy says, porridge is such a big thing with athletes, but not big in Japan at all. We had to get them to make a sample of porridge to see if it was up to scratch. And actually, they nailed it first time. So, we've now got two varieties of porridge each morning, a flavoured one and a plain one. They are going down a treat. I'm sure that suggestion went down a treat to the Japanese chefs who are responsible for some of the greatest culinary treats in the world. And there were British people storming into the kitchen being like, mix that milk with those oats. It's a very complicated recipe that you've got to nail there for the athletes. It is such attention to detail that Team GB hope will propel the biggest ever contingent they've sent to a foreign Olympics to glory. It is why they made sure the baked beans served in the preparation camp hotel were Heinz. Why 45,000 tea bags were flown in from Britain. And why there was little cause for panic when six track and field athletes were told they had to isolate in their rooms after being identified for COVID. They have gone to such lengths that they've ensured that they're getting more direct sunlight than other people, by all accounts, because Paul Ford, who is the chef de mission of Team GB, says direct sunlight is key as part of our travel strategy as we're trying to move people's body clocks faster than they would ordinarily shift. Early light exposure, he says, helps with that. Most of our flights land at 11 a.m. and the key thing is to get people into daylight in the early afternoon. Having access to natural light is the key to changing circadian rhythm. So getting the large outdoor balcony space was a big part of the negotiation. So Woo-hoo! Big outdoor balcony, loads of beans, loads of pots of porridge, loads of tea bags, that was the key. And then there was just one other...
No bonking.
No bonking is obviously goes without saying. There's one other thing. Particular attention has also been paid to the training equipment athletes are using to hone their skills in the final days. Weights are measured in kilos rather than pounds to avoid any accidents caused by incorrect conversion. They really, really have put themselves out there, the Team GB organisers. How on earth? It will be adversity that they will have to overcome if they manage to win loads of goals by not measuring things in pounds.
Balconies, beans and bonking. That is today's papers for you at 4 minutes past nine. We're going to be right back after this with Ross and Harry Byrne telling us about an exciting way that you can help the Simon community.
Technically, you can have both. There can be a little bit of contact and you can dive.
Well, you tell me which one of them weren't fouls.
Technically, they are fouls, of course.
No. Which one of them weren't fouls in your mind?
No, what I'm saying is technically...
Tell me, give me the examples of the ones that weren't fouls.
Technically, they are fouls, but also...
No, they're fouls. They're technically fouls.
Harry Kane could definitely have stayed on his feet.
No. If they're technically fouls, take out technically. They're fouls. You just said it yourself.
So we are following the progress of the Dublin Simon community's Run at Home. It's a virtual running challenge to raise vital funds for homelessness. It is spearheaded by Leinster rugby players, brothers and competitors Harry and Ross Byrne, who are taking teams on a virtual run from the 2nd to the 16th of August from Dublin to Rome, covering the host cities of the Six Nations Championship. On registration, participants will automatically be assigned to Team Ross or Team Harry, with Ross and Harry acting as team captains. Each team will work towards the collective goals of running the Triple Crown, which is just over 1,000 kilometres, and the Grand Slam, which is just over 2,500 kilometres, with the team that has clocked up the most kilometres by August the 16th winning the race. Runners and walkers of all ages and abilities are invited to take part. You can register now to clock your miles for Dublin Simon's Run at Home with Team Harry and Team Ross. And if you don't have time to run, you can buy some kilometres for your favourite team in the Dublin Simon Run at Home. Visit dubsimon.ie/runathome for more. And it is all supported by Deutsche Bank as well. So lads, Ross, we'll throw this to you first. Which team do people want to be on when they sign up for this?
Oh, Team Ross, definitely.
give us a big play here. Why should I be happy to see Team Ross rather than Team Harry when I sign up?
Just a competitive edge, you know, I think. I don't think it matters. I think either team will be good. I think it's a great idea from Dublin Simon community. Obviously, with the home run being suspended indefinitely is obviously massively disappointing for them. That's been going for nearly 40 years now, but the run at home is a great idea, and hopefully we can get loads of people involved.
Why did you get involved in the campaign?
So this is actually my fourth year with Dublin Simon community, and obviously I've from promoting the home run the last couple of years, but obviously with COVID and the Dublin Marathon's been cancelled in October, so it looks like the home run's suspended indefinitely, which is obviously massively disappointing because it's such a big fundraiser for the Dublin Simon community. It makes a huge difference to them. There's nearly 3,000 people attended it at the last home run, so hopefully we can get close enough to that number of people attending the virtual run anyway. And it's over 2 weeks, and it is a great idea, I suppose, for friends and family to get involved, get active. Hopefully the sun is still here when during those 2 weeks in August. So it's a great idea.
It's one of these things that without these events, some great causes just do not have their avenues towards fundraising. And yet, during COVID, these causes are more important than ever. The Simon community are in greater need for funds than ever.
Yes, absolutely. I think at the moment the numbers are actually skyrocketing a little bit because of COVID, and obviously the knock-on effects that COVID has had on our economy, housing, and basically the funding for the Dublin Simon community. So events like these are so important, as the home run traditionally would always be one of their biggest fundraisers, and it makes such a big difference to them. So hopefully with this virtual run, we can help raise some funds, which will go a long way.
Harry, when did you realise that, I guess, doing this sort of work is really important? I mean, it's not necessarily something that you have to do, but it's great to see people using their profile to do something positive. When did you become aware of, I guess, your responsibility and your role in all of that?
Yeah, 100%. Well, obviously Ross has been doing it, as he said, for 4 years now. It's his fourth year. So I just thought it was a great opportunity to come on board with him particularly, and we can put something together, the pair of us. Probably a bit stronger than just the one of us. So I thought the Simon community was a great idea to get involved in, especially with this campaign.
For sure. So what is the current state of play then? Are you guys strictly teammates and you've left the brotherhood behind? Or what is the state of play at the moment, Harry?
I don't know. No, we're pretty good. We're still all right. We'll see as the competition goes. Who gets more serious about it?
Who would be the most likely to take something way too seriously, Harry?
Ross, definitely Ross. Oh, sorry. He's the overly competitive one in the family.
This is a learning process, though, isn't it? I mean, like, Big Brother has to teach you a thing or two about certain things, and teaching you a thing or two about competitiveness surely can't go astray.
No, 100%. No, Ross has always been brilliant for me. Everyone kind of talks about this rivalry between the two of us, but it's anything but that, to be honest. It's fun for everyone to say it, obviously, but no, he's
been a massive help for me the whole way up.
What do your parents think when the word rivalry is thrown around? I presume they're like absolutely delighted that this two of you are doing so well.
That's why I'm the favourite, so it doesn't matter. I suppose it's obviously a weird situation, I suppose, for them. But I mean, we've always been competitive, and they're probably used to it. We're probably fighting in the garden when we're younger anyway over anything, kicking a football around. So I suppose it's nothing new. And I suppose it's probably even... I suppose it's funny because everything always gets talked about, I suppose, the rivalry, but nothing really gets talked about when we got to play together. We got to play together twice last season, which was pretty special. So I suppose moments like that are obviously brilliant for our parents, and for them, they absolutely loved it. I'd say that was probably two of the best days they probably had watching, particularly with the game in the RDS. They got to go to it as well, which was brilliant. So I suppose there obviously is that competitive nature, but I suppose it's like that throughout Leinster, really. So it's nothing really different. I mean, everyone wants to be playing, but I think everyone understands as well the squad depth we have in the club, that the squad is going to be rotating and certain players might suit certain games better.
That's class, that ability to be able to give your parents that moment. Like, do you get that back from them as well, Ross? Or is there a very sort of Irish thing here where you don't necessarily go out of your way to say, I'm very proud of you, but you can kind of feel it anyway?
No, I think, like, yeah, for them it was absolutely brilliant. And I mean, they've probably gone to every one of our games over the years, from no matter where it is, if it's Dublin abroad or up and down the country, and it could have been rugby Gaelic or whatever. So for them, it is absolutely amazing. I think they've loved the journey, and hopefully they can actually get back into the grounds and watching the games live, because it's been tough for them having to watch everything on TV like everyone else.
Did you get the call up at underage levels, Harry, to play with Ross, or is it only ever at senior level that you started to play together?
No, yeah, sure. There's 4 years between us, so we never kind of crossed even on senior cup teams in school or anything like that. But yeah, no, it was very special. When a wet, windy day in Dragons that we played in on a not so great pitch as our first day together. Ross centre, me at 10, but then to come on and play in that Dragons game, the last game of the season with people there, was really, really special, yeah. It was the first time ever we've actually been on the same team, and it was brilliant, in any sport, really.
Take us through all the other things then, that the sibling friendship, the brotherhood would have existed via. So forget rugby for a moment, Harry. What else was there when you were kids growing up?
Everything, like, anything would have. We played pretty much every sport there is, so, like, always, whether it's just kicking a football in the garden, played a bit of Gaelic for Kilmacud, but the competitive side would always, between us, would have come out in golf, probably, or table tennis, or any of those kind of sports, where you kind of go head-to-head, but yeah.
The golf scene in Leinster rugby, I dare say, is particularly competitive.
Yeah, it is, very much so, yeah.
Does anyone not play in Leinster, actually, out of interest?
There's a few, yeah.
There is a few, but the numbers have skyrocketed in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And are you all golf nuts? Like, would the WhatsApp group for Leinster be chatting about the Open at the week and stuff like that? Or is it just mostly your own little hobby on the side?
Some would be a bit more extreme than others, I suppose. Some would be very into it, and some would just be the casual golfers getting the, I suppose, watching the Open or different events, which, I suppose, give people a bit of the itch to go out.
Are we talking like Michael Jordan level of competitiveness on the golf course when you're out there?
Not for Ross, yeah, not for me. I'm a casual golfer.
So, like, when it comes to the rest of your summer, like, what is the current state of play? What is what else is there? I mean, this obviously is going to take up a bit of your time trying to get people to follow Team Harry or Team Ross over the next little while. So what else is coming up, Ross?
Yeah, so obviously there's 2 weeks out for people to register, which obviously gives them a good bit of time. Then obviously the event itself is run across 2 weeks from the 2nd until the 16th of August. And then I suppose me and Harry will do our best to try and get people signed up. I'm actually back in training in the next couple of days, and Harry's got a bit more time off because obviously he was away a bit longer with Ireland. So I'll be straight back into pre-season. So looking forward to get back into that.
Has rugby ever been played in these sort of conditions, I wonder? Like, I mean, I as you say, it's like you think of like a wet Friday night at Dragons rather than this unbelievable summer we're getting here in Ireland. Like, this could be the best pre-season of all time, Ross.
Yeah, probably start raining once we go back training, though, or something. It's always the way. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see. I'd say the sessions could be a bit tougher in these conditions, that's for sure.
Are you watching any of the lines?
The oxygen tank,
sorry.
Sorry, Mike, by the way.
No, go for that, Harry.
No, I was just saying getting the oxygen tanks out.
Yeah.
In the heat.
Have you been watching much of the Lions, Ross?
Yeah, I've watched. I didn't watch much to start. Now I watched the South African A game, well, if you can call it an A game, last week, and then watched a bit of the Stormers on the weekend as well. So, and I'll be watching the tests this Saturday. So it'll be very interesting to see how it goes after watching the A game last week.
Yeah, for sure, it should be an absolute cracker. What about yourself? How are you paying much attention to it?
I actually haven't been, to be honest. Just because obviously, just when I was in with Ireland, kind of was just focused on that, and then away from it, kind of just took a little bit of a break from rugby. But no, I'm obviously be up to date. Watch the South African A game, yeah, and be massively tuned into the game on Saturday. Be very interested to see how it goes.
What about then the last season for you lads, and I guess the hopes for next season? How would you sum up where things are going at the moment, Ross, for you?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's a strange one because you're saying it's a disappointing season, but we did still manage to win another league, which is massive. But obviously not winning the European Cup was a major disappointment. And it's I suppose it's no secret how much the European Cup means to Leinster. So it's definitely something where I suppose we target every year, but I mean, it's something we'll be really, really, I suppose, putting a focus on next season and trying to learn the lessons from last season of where we went wrong.
And when is a pre-season for you then, Harry?
Back in on, I think, the 16th of August it is, so I'll have another 3 or 4 weeks off.
And what are the hopes for next season?
Similar, just to echo Ross, I think it's to not win in Europe is massively disappointing, and it's a always the goal for Leinster is to get kind of 5 stars. So I think that's pretty much the aim for everyone going back in there, is to try collectively achieve that goal.
Good stuff. Well, the very best of luck with the season ahead, and the very best of luck to you both. It is going to be Team Ross versus Team Harry. We're going to be keeping up the speed on this as it develops. The two lads have made a very convincing pitch why you should join Team Ross, to be quite honest with you. I think, let's face it, Team Ross, you've got the upper hand after this chat here. We are following the progress of the Dublin Simon Communities Run at Home. It is a virtual running challenge to raise vital funds for homelessness. It is spearheaded by Leinster rugby players, brothers and competitors Harry and Ross Byrne, who are taking teams on a virtual run from the 2nd to the 16th of August from Dublin to Rome, covering the host cities of the Six Nations Championships. On registration, participants will automatically be assigned to Team Ross or Team Harry, with Ross and Harry acting as team captains. And each team will work towards the collective goals of running the Triple Crown and the Grand Slam, with a team that has clocked up the most kilometres by August the 16th, winning the race. Runners and walkers of all ages and abilities are invited to take part. And you can register now to clock your miles for Dublin Simon's Run at Home with Team Harry and Team Ross. And if you don't have time to run, you can buy some kilometres for your favourite team in the Dublin Simon Run at Home. Visit dubsimon.ie/run at home. And it's all supported by Deutsche Bank. Ross, Harry, thanks a million.
Thanks very much.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
19 minutes past 9 here on OTB AM this morning. The what's coming up today on Sports Radio, on OTB Sports Radio, which you can get on the sports app. At 1 o'clock, it's OTB Gold. Joe meets Ruby Walsh. At 3 o'clock, it's Dadcast. At 4 o'clock, it's our interview with John Burns. At 5 o'clock, it's the OTB Olympic Show with Indeed. That's a brand new thing on our schedule every day from 5 o'clock, and we're really looking forward to talking about it. It's time to get excited about the fact that the Olympics are here. So more of that in a couple of minutes' time. Now, our mass star Amy Mackin joins us right now to launch the John West Fela 21. No player left behind this year is the message as the John West Fela moves to under 15 level and is open to every club across the country. The 2021 John West Fela na Gael hurling and camogie events will take place on August 21st. The Fela na Nóg football competitions will take place a week later on August the 28th. And I'm delighted to say 2020 Footballer of the Year Amy Mackin is with us. Amy, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Did you play Fela, or were you too good and therefore playing senior by that stage?
No, I played. I was lucky enough I played on 3 Fela teams and also hosted it on the young club. So I have a great experience with the Fela, and I know John West are doing great work at the minute to help promote our sport even further at grassroots level and encourage healthy eating and nutrition to help fuel athletes as well.
What are your memories of Fela?
Well, actually, we had a fail in Derry and we got to the fail of final. And we were actually playing Ashley Maloney's club. They gave us a good going over. So we got beaten in the final, but it was a great experience. And you know, coming up against Ashley Maloney now against Tipperary is something that you never forget. And it's the type of thing that you meet these players when you're under 14 or 15. And then to see us playing against each other at senior level, you know, it's nice.
So when they gave you a good going over, was that like absolute devastation, the worst thing that's ever happened? Or were you kind of delighted to have played so many games in such a short space of time and reached the final? What's your recollection about how emotionally invested everybody was?
Yeah, no, I think at that age, the Féile was your All-Ireland. It was your Ulster final, you know, as such. That's the way it is for us now. When you're that age, that's the one thing that you have in your mind that you want to play during the summer. You want to get to the Féile competition. It's a great experience. It was a great weekend. It's stuff we are always talking about to this day. My brothers were lucky enough to play, so we got down on a few trips as well. So I think it's a great experience for your community. I know when we were going, I think we were in Derry and Leitrim, you know, there was a busload from our community all going down and heading down and making a great weekend from it. So apart from the football side of things, obviously when you're playing, it's as serious as any match. But outside of the football, it's just a great experience for all the young players and the families and the communities.
Yeah, and my recollection of I was never good enough to play in a team, and we never had a team that qualified, but I was young on a team, or my dad was the mentor of a team, and I remember going and like that, everybody, I was seven, so obviously I was the mascot holding the flag in the parade. I remember the parade, and I remember the fact that it takes over the whole town.
Yeah. Well, actually, we were lucky enough, we won, there's a Best Dressed Award at the parade, so we had won it a few times as well, you know, because we were all dressed in the same kit and just sort of looked professional. But yeah, even that side of things, you just getting to meet people, and we're still meeting people today that we met years back at the Féile, and you still have their memories, and we all shared their memories, so it gives us a chance to look back and talk about them and reminisce all the time. So yeah, they're lovely memories and ones we'll never forget.
How much have those people from that community stayed in touch with you over the last little while, given, I guess, your profile has, I guess, gone to a whole other level over the course of the last couple of seasons? Are they in touch? Do you get a sense that they're proud of what you're doing, especially on an inter-county level?
Yeah, definitely. I'm still in touch with people from clubs that hosted us and families that hosted myself. They're still getting in contact and sending me messages about matches that are happening today and wishing me good luck and stuff like that. So that's the nice part of the Féile, and I think that's the nice part of the GAA community in general. I think we tend to stick together no matter if there's rivalries within our own counties or whatever. So it's a nice environment to be involved in.
How are you enjoying your football at the moment? Because it seems like you've picked up this year where you left off last year.
Yeah, I think the weather makes everyone enjoy it a wee bit more. You can't be playing in the sunshine at championship season. So yeah, we're all enjoying it. I think when you're winning, you're enjoying your football even more. So that's just what we're looking to do, is win matches and take each match as it comes. We're not looking too far ahead.
What were you working on last year in terms of your own individual skill set? We're very interested in like the actual mechanics of training and how the best players continue to get better. So what are you doing in training to improve your kicking, improve your catching, improve your hand passing? Like what specific things are you working on?
Yeah, I don't think it's too complicated. I think it's just repeating the skill over and over and over again. I think when you do it many times, you tend to get a wee bit better at it. So that's literally it. Simply just working on the basic skills. And I think when you watch other footballers, like when I was young, I would have been watching plenty of matches, and you take wee snippets of the top forwards' games and how they might kick the ball, what way they do it, outside the boot, inside of the boot. So when I was younger, I was probably worked on that sort of technique side a lot more, and then I'm still developing that now. But then it's maybe a wee bit easier now that I practiced when I was younger. So yeah, it's just basics, just repeating and over again, and just trying new things. I like sort of being a wee bit off the cuff and trying something different.
What's your go-to drill, for example, then, if you just want to get that repetition going?
Well, like shooting, it would just be simply just shooting, whether it be pressured shooting or free kick practice. It would just be sort of more laid back. It wouldn't be as structured as a drill as such, because in a match, you're not really going to be having cones lined out. So it's really unstructured sort of play. just sort of kicking to a target, trying to aim for something specific in the net and just imagine it sort of thing. It's not really outlined on the pitch as such. It's just in my head, I'll create a scenario, play through it and try to put the ball over the bar in the net.
And is that like before and after our mat training? Are your teammates helping you create that scenario, or are these on your off days from inter-county training?
No, well, some of it will be in training, during training, in between drills. I might just pick up a football and do a wee bit of shooting, and then after training, I would do the same. But on off days, there is times that I go down to my club pitch and just do the same. But then off days, sometimes you don't want to see a football.
What is your position at the moment, Amy? Because obviously you're wearing 13. I think obviously the kind of the headline score from the weekend came from the left flank, with kind of the outside of the boot, and then the score against Monaghan, or the assist against Monaghan, came from the right side, but from a similarly deep position. So what sort of role are you playing at the moment?
Yeah, just the same role as last year. It's sort of in the full forward line, and just we're sort of lucky enough that our manager, he sort of lets us be creative on our own. You know, I think as a forward, you can't be too structured, as you say. It's more off the cuff and working off other people. So I think that's what we do well, is like the assist. I think Caroline spotted a gap that the full forward line had come out, and she spotted that there was a gap, so she made the run in. But I think it's just playing off the cuff. And just, it's never a set position I want to be in. It's just always movement, and wherever I end up, I try to do my best.
And when she spots the spot in the full forward line, is she shouting to you to play the ball in?
I think she might have raised her hand, but I think Caroline is probably one of the best fielders in the game throughout Ireland. So I knew when she was one on one that she would take a good beating to win in the air. So I just sort of launched it into her and hoped for the best. And you know, when she got it in her hand, she was going to put it in the net.
When you were talking earlier about watching forwards and trying to take specific bits from their games, were there any particular forwards when you were growing up that you were watching going, that's the one, or I'm picking, like, is it Colm Cooper? Was it Stevie McDonald? Who were the forwards that you were looking at?
Yeah, well, I think when I was growing up, our men and the ladies team were doing well, so we had a lot of influences.
Oh, we've just lost your sound there, Amy. There's a bit of mute. No, we're gone there.
Hello?
Yeah, we're back now there. That's it.
Yeah. So growing up, we would have watched Armagh men and followed them throughout all the Ulster finals. And
just been watching.
You're back again there, yeah?
Back, yeah.
Yeah.
I would have been watching Ashley McConville, Steve McDonald, and as you say, Colm Cooper. They were probably the top players in the county at that stage. And you'd have been watching the matches, and at half time, me and my brothers and sisters probably would have went out and were straight away practicing recreating a goal or recreating a score that had just happened. But Colm Cooper as well was probably a big one, just because he was left footer and sort of easier to watch what foot he would be kicking with, because I knew I'd be doing the same.
And are there forwards in the game today who you're watching going, I'm going to have a little bit of that? Is that how that works as well, just to kind of keep you sharp and make sure?
Yeah, still. Yeah, exactly. I think it doesn't change just because I'm older. There's still, I need to learn practice and my skills even more and keep progressing even further. I think when you watch David Clifford, there's always a highlight after each game of what he has done. So I think he'd be definitely one of the top ones to keep watching. And I sort of like the way he does sort of stuff off the cuff, and he's always surprising defenders. So that's sort of the ones I like to see and like to try.
When you're talking about trying off the cuff stuff yourself, is that you try it in training 3 or 4 times before you bring it to a match, or do you just make sure that your skill set is so honed in training that whenever the idea comes to you in the middle of a match, you're ready to go with it?
Yeah, no, I think it's exactly there what you said. I think it's just practicing my skills. I think over the years, you probably get, it's just an instinctive reaction to do the off-the-cuff stuff. You can't really, it's a hard thing to train. So I think for me, it's just about improving my skill set to know that when I am going to try something, that it's going to pay off. Now, don't get me wrong, sometimes it doesn't pay off and a defender can catch you out, but it's just about taking a risk and hoping it works out for you.
Yeah, the ability to take risks is one of the most important things in sport, because otherwise you become predictable. The buzz in Armagh at the moment, notwithstanding the fact that the men are out after the weekend, must be pretty good, because the style of play that both teams have is very expressive. It's free scoring. It's exactly what kids want to watch. It's, I presume, exactly what players want to play in. Is there a sense that football in the county is on a bit of a high, notwithstanding the fact that the men are out?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think last week, obviously, we were both playing on Saturday, and there was obviously a big hype last week, all week. Just with both games being played, everyone was just looking forward to both. I know the men's team have been doing well over the last couple of months, and you know, it's exciting to watch, and I think people are saying the exact same about our game. You know, we're just exciting to watch. I think that's the most important. We all want to watch football to get excited, and that's why we love it. So I think that was the most important thing, that people are enjoying it. And I suppose it does give the county a lift when the team's doing well or working hard. I think that's a big thing when you see a team working hard, and you know, they're going to do everything for the jersey. So it's nice to see, and I suppose it's nice to hear around even our community that people are taking interest, and they're just looking forward to the next game. That's what you always hear. They're saying, I can't wait to get to the next one. I can't wait to go again. So it's always nice.
Amy, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Cheers.
No problem. Bye.
Amy Mackin there talking to us about the John West Fela, which obviously is on over the coming weeks, and those memories, I think, are the type of memories that people never really forget. 32 minutes past 9 this morning. Jer's argument, Rí Chuldeir ahead of Meath is bulletproof, says Mark Dunning. That's all I need to see. That's it.
What was your argument again?
That they should be ahead of Meath. Right. Eamon Carrigan says, Kerry will beat Cork by 10 points plus. They may well do. Kildare seem to have some stealth field on, because they are never talked about. Every game by the Kildare game was talked about yesterday. Today, a talk about Kildare morphed into a chat about Meath, says Sort Your Life Out.
Wonder
on
why.
Well, that's Tommy Rooney's fault. And sure, you know, there's a Kerry manager. You may as well take advantage of the errorism, right?
Yeah, I mean, like we'll see. We'll see what happens with your Kerry manager over the next little while. Does he need to put in a performance? Do Kildare need to put in a performance for him to stay in the good books in Kildare?
Well, I think if they get beaten out the gate like they were last year in the game against Meath, then people would be like, okay, the league is great and everything, but, you know, maybe a championship performance in a big game wouldn't go amiss.
I see. Well, we know where your loyalties lie. It's okay.
OTBM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Not enough has been made of Daniel Flynn's goal at the weekend.
Oh, yeah. And
like, he's gone the wrong way, away from goal on the sideline, and the ball's in the net about 4.5 seconds later.
And the finish kind of was like nonchalant almost. He's just an incredible player, and great to see him back to the level that he was at in 2018. Obviously, it's not that he was off form, and he was literally not around to play in the team for a lot of those intervening years. So there's someone that you want to see in Division 1 next year, a player you can build a forward line around.
Yeah, totally. Right, James Cahill joins us tomorrow to talk hurling. We'll bring you the latest transfer news with Deal or No Deal. We're chatting to Irish golfer Olivia Mahaffey as well.